Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's January 5th, 2020, and welcome to episode 206 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I like to know.
The RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, collecting, and, you know, New Year's resolutions. We got to do it. It's a new decade. I don't know what you meant by this, Paul. 2020 is in all caps, just so you know. How do you put numbers in caps? I mean, doesn't that turn them into symbols or something?
That's right. That was the problem.
I feel like that's the way it works.
Ah, see, that's what I should have done. Should have been like @@.
Yeah, that would have worked better. I would have known right away what that was. So, hey, we got five of us. We might as well go around our pentagonal table. You like that? I know my geometries. So I'm going to go like clockwise here and start with the angry red herring, who is a.k.a. Carrington. How you doing there?
I'm amazing.
Of course.
Sum it up. It's a summary. I rock. No, doing well. Yes.
Excellent. And Jack, who isn't in the clockwise order, but I'm going to do this anyway. How you doing, Jack?
I'm doing pretty good. I'm just surprised by not being in the order either, but it's okay.
That's still 5 minutes ago.
That's fine.
Sorry. Hey, you gotta be kept on your toes.
Yeah, I thought we were the ones that did things differently.
Everyone has their own definition of clockwise, really.
No.
I mean,
no, they don't. All right, and so then we'll go backwards to Paul. How you doing?
I'm confused and fine.
Are we playing Uno? Skip two, reverse.
You're up in Canada, aren't you?
I am indeed up in Canada at the moment.
Excellent.
For the holidays.
Nice. And your internet's holding out so that you can record in that?
So far. So
we call it the internet.
And there's
perfect.
Actually not even very much snow. What's the deal? It's like warm and everything's melting.
Shh, don't tell people. We talk over whether to keep the Americans
okay.
Out.
Hey, yeah, don't talk to me about melting.
Yeah. Sorry.
Well, let's just talk to you in general, Michael, but you can tell us about your melting. How are you?
Oh, well, most of the country's on fire, except for the bits that aren't.
Yikes.
To give you guys an idea, now, you generally understand the size of England. Well, the amount of Australia that's on fire is almost the size of England. So I think we're currently, I'd say we're about 90% the size of England. Or, let's see, all of New England over in the US. But, the biggest bushfire, Gospers Mountain, Woolamai National Park, that's reach down to the northern side of the Hawkesbury River, and that's only about 35 kilometres away from me. There's been grass fires popping up, strangely. Nearest one was about 6-7 kilometres away yesterday afternoon. Unfortunately, that one was lit by little miscreants. There was another one where down just across the highway from where I work at Liverpool, and again, they think that one was deliberately set. Mother Nature's got dry thunderstorms, lightning bolts, enough wrath of the gods setting things off, and we still get miscreants lighting fires if we don't have enough to go on. It's probably the worst fire season that we've had in ages. Normally, you have a catastrophic fire in South Australia, or you have one in Victoria, or one in New South Wales. We currently have, I think, two in New South Wales, two in Victoria, one in South Australia. The Two of the fires either side of the New South Wales-Victorian border are within 10 kilometres of joining up to create another mega fire. So it's not fun, and we've been experiencing temperatures in the low 40s. Penrith had the hottest temperature on the planet at 47.8 degrees Celsius, which is in Fakenheit, flaming hot. pun.
Approximately,
yeah. So I'm glad to be just sitting down and having a chat with you guys and whoever happens to pop on by our feed. So it's not all doom and gloom, but it's not a fun time.
Yeah.
No, we get some news about this outside of Australia, you know, on our mainstream media, but I'm sure that it doesn't really cover everything that's going on. What is the prognosis? When do they think they'll have most of this under control, or is it just kind of, you don't know yet?
They're not. It's basically all just going to be contained, or at least tried to be contained. They estimate that if we have some good continuous rain, the mega fires around the place should be extinguished in a couple of months. So,
a couple of months.
Yeah. So it's just vast tracts of the country is blackened. It's horrible. Number of deaths, both of civilians and the various volunteer fire brigades. It's not good. The amount of property damage small hamlets have been destroyed. Major tourist infrastructure on Kangaroo Island has been wiped out. Kangaroo Island, South Australia, is a wonderful place. But the western third of the island, and when we say island, we basically mean something almost the size of Ireland, is basically black. They estimate 500 million animals have perished in the fires so far, and that's the wildlife. Stock losses are horrendous. It's just, yeah.
Wow.
It's bad. And stuff happens in the rest of the world as well, so, yeah.
I hope every effort is made to contain that and deal with it, and that, you know, it gets under control as soon as possible.
Yeah. But, so amongst all of that, there's still family get-togethers and retro computing and things go on. So, yeah, as sad as it is, life goes on.
It's good that you're safe and good to have you on the podcast.
Yeah, well, I've got all my fire hoses and everything laid out around the house. I've been clearing stuff because I'm on acreage here, and I go for a walk down to the creek. There's no water in the creek anymore, and everything is just dry underfoot. My grass crunches underneath your feet like straw or soft-packed dry snow. It just goes crunch, crunch, crunch as you walk through it. I will survive.
Yes. Well, I guess we should go ahead and talk about the retro computer New Year's resolutions. And I have one, but I'm going to save mine for last. And I suspect that perhaps some of you will have a similar concept in mind. But this time I truly am going to go clockwise. So, Jack, why don't you start?
Yeah.
No, I'm just kidding. Karen, go ahead.
Okay, so thinking about this, I've got a lot of the same resolutions I have every year, which I'm not really good at making actual resolutions, but I think about it. I have vague plans. That kind of counts. I probably said this on previous shows. I still want to write something significant in assembly, 652 assembler. It appeals to me, but I never get down to doing anything. So that's on my ever-present go-to list. I want to finish the Infocom games. I've been playing them with Kevin Savitz. Mentioned early, for Eaten by a Group, another podcast, and we're in the final five or six games, I think, so we'll be able to finish them this year. So that's super fun. Finally knock all of them off. So that will be a neat thing to have done, played every single one of the games. And I think other than that, I want to, weirdly, if you're watching the video and looking behind me at my massive collection of nothing, I actually want to cut down my retro collections because, I've pretty much gone all emulator now. I still have these three big Rubbermaid bins of boxes of software that I just like to play, but I'm not using them much, so I got to find a way to get rid of them
you know, start selling stuff on eBay or bring them to Kansas Fest or something. So probably going to trim down my collection, which is odd to say as the guy who doesn't even really have a collection. But I want to have even less. I'd say that's probably it. Those are my three big kind of retro goals.
Hmm. Do you think finishing up the Eaten by a Group podcast will be bittersweet? Or
Nope. It's super awesome.
It's about time.
Super awesome. Great fun. I don't know whether we'll continue and play like other games or we're going to definitely do the rest of the Infocom stuff. Like we're finishing all the text adventures and then there's a handful of graphical adventure type things like text adventure with graphics they did. Mm-hmm. We'll do those next. So we'll at least do all of the Infocom stuff. Mm-hmm. How much we'll play through Cornerstone, I'm not sure. But
I was just going to ask.
We'll at least do those.
I was going to say, I'm waiting for the database playthroughs.
So yeah. Yes.
Okay, well, I'll say that I, for one, will miss Eaten by a Gru when you finally run out of things to do because I love that show.
Yeah, we might also play other games or who knows, do Scott Adams stuff and just mock it or whatever. We haven't really talked about it, but we just want to make sure, head down, do the Infocom games first and then see. It's just super fun to podcast with a friend. He's the reason I'm playing these games. Like, I never would have got off my butt and played them solo. Like, the nice mm-hmm. thing about a podcast with co-host or co-hosts is it makes you do them. And so because we're obligated to each other to play the games, it forces us to play them. And it's a great way to be productive is just hold yourself to, like, somebody else's expectations.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, I get nothing done.
Kind of like having a workout buddy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. He said, not knowing what that's like.
So what about you, Paul? Are you going to make the obligatory New Year's resolution joke, or are you going to force me to do that?
No. See how long we can go without somebody making that joke.
All right.
Yes.
Leave it to me. Fine.
Okay. I feel like I have the same kinds of ideas every year, but I think what I would like to do is maybe try to work through the stuff one thing at a time. Like, I have this idea that I would like to take out a thing and I would like to take photos of it and maybe do a little video or whatever and move the thing along. And so I'm going to try to maybe set out a little line.
Move along as in move on to somebody else?
Yes, exactly. Get it out of my way. There are things that I want to keep, of course, but there are some things that I have only because I wanted to do that. And once I've done that, it has been done and someone else can have it in their, you know, display case or whatever. Because for me, a lot of these things that other people might put in display cases are they're sitting in like a file cabinet. That's not mm-hmm. interesting. So anyway, so that's probably what I said the last 4 or 5 years running, but this time maybe it'll happen.
Well, that's okay. Yeah. We can just keep, you know, stacking the plates back up. I know I do, which I'll talk about when we get to me. What about you, Jack?
Well, like Carrington, I also have the perennial interest in doing 6502 assembly. And doing it properly, like I can do a little bit.
Oh, I didn't say I was going to do properly. Don't put words in my mouth. Don't hold me that standard.
Okay. Well, in my mouth, I want to do it properly. What does that mean? I don't know. But just like I've been dancing around the edge of 6502 assembly programming since what, 1984 or something. Like, and I've still never really sunk my teeth into it and done it. The only time I really did any assembly for real at all was in college for some courses. And that was on 68,000, which is, you know, different. But, like, I want to get into that. That's kind of a thing. And you guys have heard me say this every year for the past so many years. But more specifically, I also want to get into doing some assembly, specifically on the Atari 8-bits, to do some things that I have only read about and never tried and want to sort of get my hands dirty doing this. This is my goal. It's a little vague. But
vague goals are achievable goals.
Yeah, exactly.
That's true.
Or in my case, apparently not.
Yeah, you can define success on the fly.
The good thing is that as time goes by, there are more and more existing projects that are available on GitHub or other places where I can actually grab somebody else's project that's written in assembly and download it and compile it myself and try it out and make changes and do things. And so this is my plan.
That sounds like a good one.
Hmm?
Yeah, that might actually be a good way to get started rather than saying, I want to build a Defender game. Like, download someone else's Defender mm-hmm. game and make it, you know, like change the shapes around a little right. or change the scoring or, you know, just fiddle with it a little to get used to it.
Right. Grab somebody's project, see if I can add some feature. If it's a game, add some gameplay mechanic, add something new to it, do something different rather than trying from scratch.
So, Jack, you're a professional programmer and I'm just a hack. But I find that when I'm trying to learn something with respect to programming, it's very useful to look at other people's work, especially if it's work that's done well, well documented. I find that learning right. by example is one of the most powerful methods to pick something up with.
Yeah.
Would you agree? Because it sounds like you're kind of thinking about that route with respect to this.
Yeah, absolutely. And to the extent that I've looked into Atari 8-bit assembly stuff, like there are some great things out there. There's like, we've talked about him before and I've emailed with him. I forget the name. The guy who has this environment called Wooston, which is built on Eclipse and is like an assembler, editor, and assembler that will build a binary for you and launch it in your emulator and all this stuff. And he's made some, I remember a couple years ago, he made some nice sort of like videos on YouTube describing how to do some things. And they're things that are common tasks that are done in a lot of Atari 8-bit games. He just kind of laid it out. Here's a little, you know, assembly program that you can create this and do this and it will do this thing. So there are examples out there, and that is definitely the best way to do it for me rather than just poking at stuff. I think when I was a kid and I first started playing with computers, I didn't have examples to look at. And that was kind of like, that's one of the things that held me back from programming for many years. It wasn't until I went to college that I actually found resources. Because I lived, you know, before college, I lived in a small town, didn't have access to a lot of things. I'd buy magazines, buy some books, but I was shooting in the dark. I didn't know where to go. I didn't know where to turn to look for things. And now there's just so much available. It's so easy to grab something that already exists and give it a whirl and see what you can do with it. Mm-hmm. That's a great way to get started.
We're all dancing around the word plagiarism a lot, I assume.
A good artist copy, great artist steal.
I originally said that.
Picasso quoted you then, I think.
Don't believe everything you read on the internet, Abraham Lincoln.
Right. I love that quote.
You were saying that it's, you know, sometimes it's good to look at stuff that's well commented, but I know when you said that, I just was thinking of some of the, like, I don't know, the various libraries and stuff that I've looked at where it does sometimes seem to me like you can over comment things. Like, I find it actually a little bit hard to understand something where there's like three pages of comments and then a little bit of like a couple of lines of code and then three more pages of comments. It's like, I can't see it all at once. So somewhere in right. between is the optimal, I think.
I tend to prefer conceptual comments. Like if I don't know the syntax at all of something, mm-hmm. then I should probably be backing off and learning some of the syntax before I get started. I don't need to see X equals X plus one and then a comment that says add one to X. I'd rather see something that explains what X is used for in this program.
Why am I doing it? Not what am I doing?
Exactly.
Yes.
And that's always the goal in commenting code, is you want to make it descriptive of the purpose of it.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Yeah.
And if something is simple enough that someone who understands the syntax of the language can grasp it without comment, you don't need to comment. Mm. But if something is like, if there's a function that has a few inputs and does a bunch of math with them and gives you an answer, and maybe you can understand each piece of what's going on, but if the function just has a terrible name like do math, you won't understand what it's calculating, and so you need to have some kind of documentation that explains, here's what we're doing, here's why this looks the way it does. Mm-hmm. That kind of thing.
I'm a terrible commenter. My comments are always like jokes, and I tell lies. I'm like, ha ha, future me, think you can figure this out, and like, yeah. I don't know why I do that. I'm awful to myself.
Because it's entertaining.
Yeah, basically. I find it hilarious while I'm doing it, and then I'll go back to the software like 2 years later. Why am I such a child? Tell me why. Look,
my commenting must be a blend of Carrington and Jack, because I use a narrative style and try to describe why I'm doing it, not the how. But even things in there, so like I have to sometimes censor my comments before I push something to production, because it might go, this is hard, I'm off to get a coffee.
back from coffee, X equals X plus one.
I just edit it down, like, this is coffee, and let people figure it out.
I'll be testing my beeping button.
Oh, at least for me, coffee's easy. I just, at work, I just reach over and put the mug under the espresso machine, drop a capsule in, and hit double.
Mine are more like things like, I'll put X equals X minus 2, and then my comment is, X knows what it did. Why? How was that helpful? I don't know, but I thought it was funny, so there you go.
Oh, my. Well, Michael, do you have any resolutions for 2020?
I think my main resolution is to attempt to bring order unto chaos.
I feel attacked.
The 8-bit bunker has become, it's sort of become an 8-bit dumping room. I've just got stuff all over the place. So I'm trying to cut back on purchases. I think I failed already. What's today? The 6th?
Today's the 5th. Well, it's the 6th for you.
The 5th, yeah. Okay, yeah, it's the 6th. So let's see. 2020, I've ordered 2 new Heathkit continuing education packages, a Toshiba Librettos 50CT.
Nice machine.
Yeah, it is a nice machine.
It's the 5th.
Yeah.
The 5th, yes.
About 2% through the year.
Yeah, 2% through the year. I think I've already made half a dozen purchases.
More than one computer per day is hoarding, dude.
Okay, if you have the space.
Yeah. Well, that's the problem. I'm running out of space because I haven't been curating my hoarding.
It's only an 8-bit bunker. You can only have up to 255 items.
That's good.
That's quite a door.
Yeah, and you're heading for zero, my friend.
Major overflow.
And mainly order unto chaos, because I know that here in the bunker I have my Fujitsu document scanner somewhere.
It's under all those books
I've
about
lost,
hoarding.
Yes, folks. Yeah, folks, I've misplaced a scanner. Oh, that was the other thing I bought. I bought a new document scanner just in case I can't find this one.
It's often easier.
Yeah, but the problem is the one that I bought is A4 only. The one I'm trying to find is A4 and A3 so that I can pull staples out of magazines and just run the full sheets through because it's also a duplex A3 scanner, so quite handy.
Wow, an automatic document feed with A3 capability?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Nice.
Yeah. In both thick and thin paper stock, so it's quite good. So I really would like to find it. I think I boxed it up and took it to a meetup somewhere, so the boxes come back, which has meant that it's neatly stacked, probably under a couple of meters of other stuff. So, that's the trials and tribulations of being a hoarder, collector. Archivist. Yep. Archivist, yes. So... that's the main one, but the other one is I've got all of these education packages. I want to complete the digitization of their media, which includes 33 RPM LPs. I've got in the Heathkit stuff all of these square flexi vinyl recordings.
Oh, cool.
I've got some EAV educational software has film strips in it. Unfortunately, when I opened up those canisters, I was greeted with a lovely aroma of vinegar. So those film strips have all redshifted.
Ooh.
Maybe they're just moving really quick.
No, they're not moving quick. There's all the photos that I scanned on there. So you can see that they're actually a combination of black and white and color photos, and they're all a lovely shade of magenta.
Yeah.
So I've tried color shifting, not being very successful. So I think all of them are going to be kept in the redshift and the media packages that I'll be putting up to Internet Archive. I'm just going to change them all to grayscale. But again, that's the problem of dealing with mass-produced material back from the 70s. It was never designed to last. You know, it was going into school, so they kind of expected it to last, 5-10 years, maybe a bit more at a stretch. But, it's now 2020, and, 50-year-old mass-produced film strips just aren't cutting it. And so I suppose the upshot is at least I'm archiving it to black and white. So I've got a whole lot of other educational material and multimedia packages from the 60s, from the 70s. And I thought I'd better get those archived and made available. So stay tuned for 50 Shades of Beige, the YouTube channel.
Well, that's nice that they're not being lost. Even if the quality is degraded a little bit, you've got the material.
Yeah.
That's a good thing.
So I've got the I've captured the audio, and I'm just going to keep the little bings in there for when I do the YouTube slideshow, so that people can get the full high school immersive multimedia experience.
I love those.
Nice.
Yeah. So yeah, things have come a long way.
Sometimes you can have you can find like marketing photos and stuff that will actually show you. You know, they'll lay out the stuff and maybe unroll a little bit of the film strip. You might be able to see what the color would have looked like in some of the photos.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I had a look in the what was the big project that Kevin and did that all scanning of the junk mail and things. I went for a look through there. There's no mention of any EAV or any of the other Heathkit type things, but I'm going to keep looking. There's not much out there on the intertubes for this stuff. So, again, I do want to try and scan as much of this stuff, get it up the Internet Archive, and then put some presentation packages together. But back on the 6502, it'd be nice to relearn 6502, maybe even IBM Assembler 360 or something like that from my glory days of programming. I think I'd have to almost go back to learning Assembler by scratch.
Did you do some 360 programming back then in Assembler?
In Assembler, I started doing some, but I wasn't in the network software area, so the manager there basically gave Winnie and myself the kibosh on doing some utilities. So they said, oh, if you leave, we'll have to maintain these utilities. Mm. And so we went and wrote them in COBOL.
Sure.
Well, so one of us has to say this. So you started with 360, and now you've come full circle?
Yeah, you win the internet. Yeah,
very nice.
Yeah,
well, you could use Hercules to
I could. That's another little project which I've got buried on a hard drive somewhere. Hercules was quite fun. Mm-hmm. But for those not to know, Hercules emulation system for if you want to reminisce your IBM mainframe days or retorture yourself, whichever. So
oh, is it my turn?
All right.
Well,
you're a clockwise from Michael. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I've got one of the same things as everybody, which is to scale down the collection. I want to do it intelligently, but I don't know. I may have to just do it stupidly because I've got an explosion of stuff, and I think 2020 is actually the year where my desire to have a right-sized collection may be stronger than my desire to get the utmost money or care or whatever out of getting rid of the stuff. So some of the things may be going at, you know, fire sale stuff. Some may be just
come on down to Crazy Earls.
No, don't use that word.
Oh, sorry.
Mind you, I was going to say there's one way I could downsize my collection. I could just take the storage boxes outside and just let Mother Nature take care of it.
All right. Blue light special. How's that?
Okay.
Is that better?
That's better.
Okay.
Yeah.
That.
Yeah. Not that we've seen lots of those flashing around down the highways going off to put out fires. Oh, sorry.
another thing that I've had on my list for a while, I came close, didn't quite get there, was taking an FPGA, getting a 6502 core on it, and then getting enough other goodies on it to make a system on a chip with an FPGA. So it's actually pretty trivial, believe it or not, to take a 6502 core and put it on an FPGA. There's a few of them out there that are simple, they're good, pretty darn accurate. What is a little bit more complicated is then now you've got a running 6502, but what are you going to do with it? You got to get some input and output, put some ROMs in so that when it lights up, it actually does something when it first boots up. That's a bit more tricky. I got to the point where I could actually flip some switches on my FPGA board and have the 6502 read the contents of that as a byte and then spit that back out on another memory address to some LEDs. So it showed me that this is possible, but I'd like to do a little bit more, like get a 6502 computer that could actually speak some variant of BASIC or FORTH or something like that. So that's one of my fun propellerhead projects that I'd like to do
in 2020.
Cool.
Also, one more thing to give myself some more space. It's a set of documentation for Vax VMS for version 4.4. These are both super awesome to have and the bane of my existence because I've got a full set, what the deck people would call the wall of orange that I have of these things. There's got to be like 30 of them or something like that. And a lot of them are the big 8.5 by 11, just chock full of documentation. And scanning them, I've scanned quite a few of them, and I feel like I haven't even made a dent. And they take up a huge amount of room. And once I'm done with that, I've got a bunch of other deck documentation besides that wall of orange. So in 2020, I'm either going to get them scanned or give up. I don't know which one it's going to be, quite honestly. It's not like the world is, everybody's beating down my door, clamoring for the VMS 4.4 documentation. Maybe nobody would care if it never got scanned. But I know from looking around at the sites out there, it doesn't seem to be archived. Nobody's got it.
And maybe now that you're teasing it here, Earl, maybe now people will be waiting for it.
They might. Yeah. And, you know, I posted on the Vintage Computer forums about this and said, I've got this. Yeah. This is going to be an amazing amount of work. Does anybody want it? Does anybody care? And a couple people came back and they said, well, yeah, it'd probably be good if you scanned them. And I thought, that's not exactly a rousing endorsement. So,
oh, enthusiasm.
Yeah. So anyway, that either succeeds or fails this year. That's it. I'm putting my stake in the ground. Yeah. And those are my New Year's resolution. Yeah. And aside from that, 1024 by 768.
Yes.
Someone had to.
Yeah.
Yeah. If I was closer and I could find it, I'd loan you my document scanner. Sounds like it'd be perfect for it.
Yeah. I actually do have an ADF scanner, and it works really well. It's a nice Kodak Alaris scanner.
Okay, cool.
It's got some cool features, like it'll remove the punch holes. It'll straighten a document that goes in slightly crooked. It does a lot of things automatically to clean things up as it's scanning. So I like it. It's still a lot of work. Cause I mean, you can't take the whole book and cram the whole thing in there. You know, you got to go like 50 sheets at a time or whatever it is.
Yeah.
And these are old,
that's what I've been doing.
These are old books too. And the problem with that is sometimes the pages stick together. Sometimes.
That lovely toner, and peeling the inside page off the inside front of the folder.
Yeah, that can happen too. Luckily, these seem to have been stored in fairly good climate conditions, so they don't have that problem. I've got some other books that have that problem.
I remember the deck wall of orange. Jack, you might also remember this. The computer room, the computer lab, there was one of these walls of orange. So I have my own little nostalgic memory of that. And I did look stuff up, you know, how to do stuff on the command line and stuff in some of these. Mm-hmm. But I think I might have one of those binders somewhere, but I don't need the wall.
You don't want them? Okay. I didn't want to deprive
they're cool
you.
Looking, though.
If you, they do actually look really neat. I have to admit, I'm going to keep a few of these loose leaves when I'm done just to store, you know, whatever other kind of documentation, even after I'm done doing all the scanning. But anyhow, okay. Enough with resolutions. We should move on to some other topics. I guess the next one would be listener feedback. Paul, who's talking to us?
All right. Well, let's see. So we got some email from some people. So Todd wrote over email to alert us to the fact that Captain's Quarters BBS has added an ASCII Express line.
What does that mean?
Well, I wanted to mention this because it gives us a chance to talk about that because we're already like 35 minutes in. I think ASCII Express is only an Apple thing.
I think it's only Apple II. So yeah. I only know of it as an Apple II program.
Yeah, but it was basically a file transfer program, but it allowed you to set up a unattended remote, so people could call in and they could connect to the ASCII Express line and download the wares, you know, or Linux distributions or whatever it is you download.
I'm sure it was all open source.
Yeah. So it was basically, and actually ASCII Express was a little bit more inclusive of different modems. Like there were a couple of different sort of important file transfer, you know, systems in the wares underground, and ASCII Express was the one that everybody could use. CatFur was the one that I was a little bit more familiar with, and that required an AppleCat 2 modem. So, but and I actually have no idea how. So it has an AE line. I don't know how you use it, but you can log in, and I suppose if you can figure out a way to connect your Apple II to the captain's quarters BBS over like a Wi-Fi connected modem, then you might actually just be able to download things off the AA line, which is interesting.
Hmm.
Carrington, have you used these before? You sounded familiar at least.
Oh, way back, like forever ago. Yeah. I don't know what the utility would be now, except as like a nostalgia thing or a way to show people what it was like to download a bunch of stuff and then reassemble it into a disk. It's strictly for wares. But I also was more familiar with cat fur, but it's the same sort of thing. Mm-hmm. I think there was disk fur, not dog fur, disk fur or something like that was another one. But I was aware of ASCII Express, but they're all the same thing. Basically, it's way to get wares out of your BBS.
Yeah. And there was a program, I think, that was pretty much specifically just for this purpose also, called Dalton's Disk Disintegrator. And so everything was compressed with this thing that would basically make your whole disk image into something small enough that you could store the image on a disk, right? You know, like the compressed part. So, So you could show your nieces. It's like, this is what we did, you know. We connected, and okay, now we're going to go do something else for 4 hours.
Right, and hope.
Yeah.
Come back and see.
So that's neat, if you want to try that out. Chris wrote over email a couple times ago. We kept, for several episodes in a row, we were asking, what is 14.2504 megahertz? And
we didn't have
Michael's
Michael
here
on
now.
To tell us.
Yeah. We were asking it with some level of frequency.
That's very true. Yes. But, so, and I, for some reason, I missed this feedback back when we were talking about it before, but it was actually pretty interesting. So I kind of wanted to read through some of it just because I found it interesting anyway. This basically has to do with the all the different clocks that the Apple II needs. So there's a 14-ish megahertz crystal that runs all of the different clocks. And the reason it's 14 is because there are all these different, we need something to go at 3.5 megahertz and something to go at 2 and something to go at 1 and something to go at 7. And this is like the common denominator. Like you can split 14 into all of those other numbers. So color video requires a 3.5 megahertz frequency, and the video display needs something roughly like 1 megahertz signal to get the bits from the video memory and under the beam in time. Both the Apple II and Apple III split a 2 megahertz clock for what are they doing? CPU tasks and video tasks. And then actually in the Apple III, you can turn off the video and speed everything up by twice, pretty much, by just saying like, I don't want any of the video, just do it all, put everything in the CPU. So it sort of like just shuts down the screen. I put it in the show notes, I put all kinds of numbers and stuff that I, as I'm looking at it, I'm thinking, I probably don't need to read those. But one thing that is kind of interesting about the Apple II, that I think not everybody knows, even Apple II people, which is that it doesn't actually go exactly at 1 megahertz, because it has to stay in sync with this exactly 3.5 megahertz. It's not exact, but there is an exact number that the video has to go at. So there's one cycle that gets stretched a little bit. So there are 64 fast cycles and then one slower cycle, and then 64 fast ones and one slower. So it's, which kind of messes things up if you're trying to do things like interface with a different processor or run your disk drive. So you have to be aware of that.
Some kind of scaled down multiple of the NTSC color burst frequency? Is that what you're saying? Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is something like 3.5 megahertz.
Mm-hmm.
And then 14.2504 specifically is the PAL version. 14.318 is the NTSC version. Anyway, okay. It was more interesting in my head.
No, but it is interesting. I know that there is some similar math behind the numbers on the Atari 8-bits, the clock speeds of the CPU and other components in there. And for the same reason, it's all based around how to output video in NTSC and in PAL and how to get the right number of pixels and color clocks and all these things. I don't know the details at all, but there is a similar thought behind it there as well.
So I wonder if the Atari also has a slow cycle like that. I mean, because it has the same the same constraint. It has to try to match that color burst.
Yeah, except it does something different because since the CPU isn't driving the video, since there is a video chip that does that, and so that's why the 6502 in the Atari runs at something like 1.79 megahertz. So the CPU is not constrained by that, but the other chips are, and therefore the CPU is constrained by the speed at which, with which it will communicate with them in some way. So like there's a similar sort of like division of a big number into smaller numbers for all these things. I just don't know it off the top of my head at all.
It seems like the video would slow things down on a lot of systems. Like the Commodore 128 got around that by, if you turn off the 40-column video and just have the 80-column, which is handled by another chip, then it can go at 2 megahertz. But if you're using the 40-column video, then it can only go at 1 megahertz.
Okay.
So, like, worse in both respects or better in both respects.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
On the Atari, the only thing I remember that shut off the video in order to make things work faster or better was if you were running SAM. You guys remember SAM? Software Automated Mouth? So that would run and turn the screen black because it was using all the CPU to generate the sound. And like, and I think because of the timing of the CPU alongside the chip that actually made the sound, there was something that they had to sync up there. They're just like, they couldn't be bothered with displaying anything. So just like it went black, if I remember correctly.
Okay, continuing on. Anders wrote over email, I think commenting on, we had talked a couple episodes ago, I think, about a Commodore 64 program that was hidden at the end of a LP or something.
Yes.
And Anders just wanted to say that everybody knows what a Commodore 64 program sounds like because everybody tried to copy a tape that their friend had. So everyone will recognize this.
I did not.
Yeah. You know, I think that might have been, I'm wondering if that was more prevalent in Europe than it was in the U.S.
What, piracy?
I think so.
No, not piracy.
Cassettes instead of
cassettes took more hold in the U.S. at first.
Yeah.
You know, more like right off the bat in the Commodore world than it did in Europe, where cassettes for things like the 64, the ZX Spectrum, you know, a handful of other machines, cassettes were still in use, active use, like long after they'd kind of faded away in the U.S.
Mm-hmm. True. Okay, and then the last thing in this feedback chunk is Michael wrote over email. So he said a few years ago, there was some discussion about his PC Junior running a web server, but then by the time we'd gotten around to checking it out, he'd shut it down. So, sorry. We're slow. I put a note to myself to find the prior episode, and I did not, but sometime in our past.
But he is the one who wrote that TCP/IP stack for old DOS machines, right?
Yeah, that must be MTCP. Does that sound right?
Yeah. Yeah, that's the one. Yeah, it's an amazing piece of work, you know, being able to run TCP/IP and some of the common utilities on like an old 5150 or 5160.
Well, so what he wrote to us was that he just released a new version of this. And so kind of, I don't know, in celebration, he also fired up the PC Junior web server again.
Yay!
So as of the time of recording, it had been running for nearly 2 days and will be up for at least 2 to 3 more. So by the time you hear this, it'll probably be gone.
It's gone.
But he's basically said that he's got the MTCP page has a link that has those pages themselves also served by the PC Junior if you want to see it. So that's kind of cool. So everybody go, you know, right now go link to it and see if you can take it down.
Slash dot that baby.
But he said the PC Junior is configured as an NEC V20 CPU at 4.77 megahertz. So I guess that's an upgrade from the Intel 8088, a Junior IDE adapter, which supplies most of the RAM on the machine, a 20 gigabyte spinning disk, Max Store, and a WD8003WT Ethernet adapter on a homebrew ISA bus adapter. Anyway, it's kind of cool that the old machine is doing something allegedly useful.
Yeah, at this moment, it looks like the server has been up running for 95 hours.
Cool.
Since January 1st.
It's longer than a Windows server.
All right. So anyway, yeah, I think that's enough of the feedback. There's one more bit of feedback that I turned into an item I'll talk about later. But So we can now get into the cheery business of our items of interested news.
We can, yeah. And unfortunately, this time around, we've got some more sad news to report. This definitely was pretty widely reported in the retro computer community. Carrington, I'll go ahead and turn it over to you.
Chuck Peddle's dead. I don't know.
Yeah.
You guys are so somber, but it sucks. But the reality is, yes, we have a bunch of news about people who have passed. And one of the ones that came up recently was the passing of Chuck Peddle. Superstar name, somebody who we have obviously mentioned a bunch of times. And one of the big names behind the 6502, still my favorite chip that we've already mentioned on the show. And it's the one I would like to write assembler. And so maybe this year that'll give me that motivation to do it. Bunch of sites that are just like, one thing that is difficult in making links for our show notes is news sites are terrible. I don't know if anybody's noticed, but you try to go to any news site and it's just a billion pop-ups and full screen ads. And it's just, I looked and looked and looked to try to find like a good article that I feel okay with linking to say, here is something on the passing of Chuck Peddle. Mm-hmm. The best I could do really is just say the team6502.org site, which is a really good site, has some info about Chuck Peddle. And I think that could be our primary link, because like every news site that picked it up, like every single one of them is just a dumpster fire of a website. Just terrible. Yeah. So difficult to link to anything that's news on the internet anymore. So I guess in a sense, the internet also died. So.
Not to get too far off topic, but I got to say, I hate swatting popovers and pop-ups and, you know, jump arounds. And it's like, I just want to look at the content. If you can give me the other information that you want to throw at my eyeballs in some way that I can consume it without you like radically ticking me off, then please do that instead, because then maybe someday I'll actually come back to your site. But
yeah, I read a lot of good ad blockers, but I often disable a bunch of stuff before I put links into the show notes, so I know what like the general people are going to go to.
They don't work with those popovers, though. Those things just jump up and you got to hit the X no matter what. I mean,
I'm pretty good, I think. I don't get a lot of those.
Really?
But I mean, they're awful. The sites are so terrible. Mm. But Team 6502 site has a good, just a good kind of write up about the 6502 and Chuck in general. There's also a really good, an overview called The Legendary Chuck Peddle at Commodore.ca. Yay, Canada. Which is it's terrific. Like that was my favorite of all the write ups about Chuck Peddle's, inventions like the 6502, but the pet and like just all the things. So there's just so many things. Now this site does claim an interesting idea that he goes on in 1976, I guess it would be, or 75 to 76, 77. I don't know. Makes a pet, Commodore Pet, which this site says is the world's first personal computer. I've got thoughts. I've got disagreeable thoughts. I've got so many disagreeable thoughts.
Dangerous word first.
So it's a really unfortunate. Like I mean, I guess everybody passes. It's a shame, but I think it's a real loss, because this is somebody who was at the a major part of something that became a major part of so many things that we talk about and celebrate on the show. Like he's just like at the heart of the beginning of all of it, like the big fork, the 6502 and all that, like just such an amazing thing. And then the last thing I'll mention is on Hackaday, they had a great thread called Honoring Chuck Peddle that we talk about that. And so it takes kind of a different spin on things that has a lot of nice comments and stuff. So we'll have a few links in the show notes to talk about it. And this is just the first of many things we're going to talk about dealing with death in this show today. Woohoo! Welcome to 2020.
So one thing I would mention about the Hackaday thing is it's written by Bill Hurd, who is also a big Commodore name, at least the overview article. And I guess one other thing that is good, I think, about Chuck Peddle's being was that he was very sort of open to talking to people. He was there were a number of interviews that he's given even recently, you know, that sort of talking about the industry, and like I think he did a pretty good information dump of what he knew, and he seemed pretty delightful to talk to. Earl, did you not interview him on Retrobits?
A little over 10 years ago, I had a 3-episode special with Chuck Peddle. He was an absolute joy to talk to. He's very energetic, very giving of his time, and had amazing recollection of his personal history and all the milestones and anecdotes and other colorful items that he could remember and articulate very clearly. And, you know, it was just, it was an awesome interview. And I thought it was an amazing privilege to talk to, you know, as a personal hero of mine, as well as I think thousands or millions of other people. So, and yeah, he's done more recent interviews with a lot of people. Didn't he have a chat on the Amp Hour podcast, I thought? And there were some other places where there are some videos you can find where in some Commodore events he'd gotten on a video and chatted with folks. And also, I just another thing to say is that he was involved in technology. He stayed involved in technology. It was one of the things he talked about on Retrobits was he was doing some work with flash memory circuits and how to reclaim certain amount of flash memory, things that might have been partially defective, but there was some innovative way of recombining them or something and repurposing them. Anyway, just an amazing guy.
So before we move on to, unfortunately, there's more people recently passed. Another, we'll kind of dunk in and talk about somebody who passed a while ago, but made it back in the news on just before Christmas. For some reason, Polygon ran a really nice article called The Man Who Made Wolfenstein about Silas Warner, who passed a while ago. But I don't know what prompted this article, but it's really, really good. It's like a long, in-depth look at Silas Warner and his impact on gaming and through Muse and all of that. Just really great. So I thought we'd just have a link to that in the show notes as well, so we can talk a bit about Silas Warner too. Before we go on to that, I'll also mention the weirdness that's coming up on the internet when I'm trying to find links to things. So this was a great article on Polygon written by Colin Campbell. And then the exact same article appears on a whole bunch of other news sites credited to other things. Like here's one on a site called newsdio.com, and it's just by admin. Exact same article, word for word, except like 5 or 6 words get changed, including a gender. One thing changes one person's gender all the way through. I don't know why that happened. But otherwise, it's just a complete ripoff. So again, like the internet is just full of like the exact same story, slightly twisted, and then you have to look to try to find like where is the original. And it was one of these knockoff articles I saw first, and then I discovered the original is actually on Polygon. So we'll link to Polygon and probably not link to some of these other knockoff sites. But it's a weird thing that's happening recently where the exact same articles are cut and pasted, and then they change like 4 words, same graphics, same everything, attributed to somebody else, and just stick it on your own news site.
Yeah, there was one. I mean, maybe this is the place to mention it, even though it was in a different butchered article that you mentioned. But they changed something like inch by inch to of thumb of thumb.
Yeah, thumb of thumb. What's
important? I understand. I can sort of see there's a like a French connection there, but why would it be translated in and out? I don't understand.
It's weird.
Yeah.
So, Man Who Made Wolfenstein, the late Silas Warner is barely remembered in gaming, but he did something extraordinary. Aha, I'll leave you with that tagline. But it's a really, really good article, so highly recommended. Mm-hmm. Paul, I think you put a bunch of links about Silas Warner as well, right?
Yeah. So I stuck a couple of – just a couple of things to mention. We don't need to spend a lot of time talking about Silas Warner necessarily. But he gave a talk at Kansas Fest in 1992 that somebody audio recorded. And so we'll have a link to that. You can listen to that. It's pretty interesting talking about the sort of early Apple software. And the Digital Antiquarian had a good article about Silas Warner and the beginning of Muse software. And then there was in the Digital Antiquarian site, there was a link off to a site that has some remembrance, comments. It was basically just sort of a quick note of some sort, but a lot of people found it and put comments on it, and so there are people who are like someone who is Silas's college dorm mate and colleagues from Muse, and The guy who bought the IP later put a comment in, and so it's pretty interesting. And so I'll have a link to that, and then also a link to that same site on the Internet Archive, just in case that site goes away, because it might someday. But actually, in the wake of this Polygon article, you know, that Remembrance site itself has been getting some new updates. So I think there was one, you know, there was something even added just 3 days ago. So it's still a, or at least it is now again, a, you know, live site.
Cool. In looking up about this and seeing, trying to like find stuff about Silas and things, I stumbled across a little site. I don't know if you guys have heard of it, called yesterbits.com.
Yeah, yes.
And you, Paul, did write up about Muse and ABM, and it's in your article that I learned that Muse was originally an acronym for Micro Users Software Exchange, which I did not know. I thought it was just the word Muse.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I also did not know that until I got the thing that told me that. But I mean, yeah. You have more. Do you want to keep going?
Yeah, was that it for now, Carrington, or did you want to...
No, there's more death. Going. The death theme continues, unfortunately. In the article, it's listed as a late collector. Fellow named Adam Rosen had a big collection of Apple-based things, both mostly Macintosh, and passed away. But nicely, the collection has been picked up by the American Computer and Robotics Museum.
Hmm.
I think this is one. This is the one where, because there's a subheading, American Computer and Robotics Museum, quote, inch for inch, the best. And of course, there is ripoffs of these articles. There's one over at BollyInside.com, which changes that to thumb for thumb, the best. I don't even understand.
Well, inch was a thumb.
But still.
Yeah.
Still. What the heck, man? In terms of different parts.
It's been transliterated and then back into English, so yeah.
Yeah, but this is a nice thing where somebody had like a big collection that meant a lot to them, and then people have gone and tried to find a new home for it, to keep it together, not necessarily trying to sell it, but just trying to find somebody who would take care of it and appreciate it for like the great collection it is. So it's really nice that a museum has said, yeah, you know what, we can totally make use of that. So it's the American Computer and Robotics Museum in Bozeman, Montana, is going to take the whole collection and be able to put some or all of it on display, and like that's fantastic. So that's somebody who's collection will be, you know, really cared for like after they pass, which I don't think a lot of people can hope to actually happen with their collections. So this is really nice.
Yeah, he did. He actually had this was set up as kind of a museum that you could visit on demand. Like you could, like, it was in his own personal space, but you could go see it if you talked to him. And I never did, which is very sad, but I did meet him. He was collecting sort of things that had that, what is called Picasso art for the Mac things, and you know the Apple stuff of the 1984 era. And I had something for printers that he didn't have, and so he wanted to get that. So I did meet him.
Cool.
So it's good. And I think this museum in Bozeman is, I think we've mentioned it before. I mean, like, I think it's a pretty prominent museum.
Mm-hmm. And it wasn't too long ago, if we're talking about the same museum, that sadly the person who had created that museum had passed away.
I knew I'd heard about it recently, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Happy 2020, everyone.
Yeah.
We're halfway done.
We're halfway done our discussion.
Obituary
continue. It's a theme.
Was that it, Carrington?
Or, that's it.
Okay, well...
I think Jack has more death.
No, Jack, you've got some good news for us, right?
Moving on, I've got some more death.
Oh, man.
Our friend, our fellow roundtabler, Ken, who isn't with us today, he has a nice article in Computer World.
Ken's
about, kind of ominous where you're beginning to
trend. Yeah. He's not
with us.
He's not with us today on the podcast.
Especially today, you need to qualify
in spirit.
That. Yeah.
Yes, he's with us in spirit. And he wrote an article that's in Computer World, Tech Luminaries We Lost in 2019. This is not strictly speaking only computer industry or anything, by any stretch. And the reason this came up is he posted it on Facebook, and I commented, why isn't Chuck Peddle here? And he said, well, he just missed the deadline because they had a publishing deadline for this couple weeks earlier.
Deadline.
So.
Oh, come
yeah.
on.
Sad.
That'd make a good Infocom game, wouldn't it?
Deadline. Anyway, yes, so there is a number of people who died here, some of which I did not know about and some I did know about, and it's all interesting. So take a look if you want to find out about more sad deaths.
Well, yeah. It was a fascinating article in that, like you, Jack, I didn't know about some of those folks, but reading about them in that article and their accomplishments, I thought was fascinating. Mm-hmm. It was good that that was memorialized. Is that the right word? Yeah, like that.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It was good.
Yeah, I commented back with Ken that I was hoping that the 2020 article would be a very short one, but unfortunately, we're filling the list up early.
Yeah. Well, Michael, I know you've got to have some good news for me.
Well, yeah, I suppose it is good news, though it does sort of involve people dying. Here in Australia, there's a YouTube channel, Lurch's Things, and he is doing a charity auction of one of his prized computers to raise funds for, here in New South Wales, the Rural Fire Service. That's the volunteer bushfire brigade. Mm. I think last count there was over 50,000 volunteers in the RFS, ironically, some of them are actually deployed to other states helping with those bushfires, and then our own bushfires here have erupted. But what is being auctioned is a MicroBee Premium Plus. So it's a 128K MicroBee computer, which is an Australian designed and built Z80 computer. And it has a reworked expansion card. So all of the componentry of the traditional expansion card has been shoved down to one end, and then using a FPGA and some other electronics, it has a SD card floppy disk emulator built in, and a few other bits and pieces, including a RJ45 networking jack. Basically, Jason is auctioning this. He's going to split the proceeds of the auction. Half of it's going to go to the RFS fundraising site, and the other half is going to go to his RFS brigade that he used to be a volunteer for. So when I last looked, this auction was basically at about $1,100 Australian, and I'm hoping that it will find a good home for a very, very healthy donation.
Mm-hmm. Hopefully it'll go up quite a bit from there. How long has it got to go? Oh, 6.5 days.
It's a beautiful machine. Even just as a MicroBee 128K machine, it is in beautiful condition. Mm-hmm. He does there's a YouTube, there's a link to his YouTube channel, Mr. Lurch's Things, where he actually gives a bit more information, demonstrates it being used, advises that the keyboard is currently working, but that these machines have a history of some flakiness in the keyboard over time. But it is a very nice machine. So if someone overseas wants to have a little bit of Australiana into their collection, I could not endorse this machine more. As I said, it's an Australian designed and built Z80 machine. It was very big in the schools. It went toe-to-toe or thumb-to-thumb with the Apple in the school system here in Australia. It went under as the behemoth deployed more than it could, MicroBee could handle. But
and one of the nice things about the auction is shipping, I think, is covered if you're within Australia. But if you're overseas, he said,
he's going to split the shipping.
So don't be scared off if you're in North America or something. You think, it's going to cost too much to get it shipped. One, it's for a good charity. And also, you're going to split the shipping. So it might be the best opportunity to even get one of these things. So all signs point to a good thing to bid
on. So it's already been shared to our Facebook group. So hopefully it'll get a little bit of interest in there. But as I said, if you are looking for an Australian computer for your retro computer collection, you can't really go past a MicroBee 128K machine. And go look at the YouTube video, and he basically gives a rundown on the expansion card that's in there. Now, it really is great. And there are disk images for Linux. So there's a Z80 Linux that you can actually run on this, and he demonstrated that running as well. So sorry, this is Z80 for you guys.
Well, no, Carrington goes with that.
Nah. No, yeah.
Paul has to, too, because he's in Canada at the moment.
That's
true.
That's right, yeah, okay, yeah. But, yeah, it's great. And as Karen has said, shipping within Australia is going to be picked up by Jason, and he will split the shipping for an overseas purchaser.
Excellent. Well, Paul, you might as well dogpile on this theme.
All right, here we go. Adding to the people who have passed away that we've been talking about, we lost Mike Harvey, who was the founder of Nibble magazine. That's the way that I know him.
It's a stinker.
Yeah. And a positive side of this is that he actually just came not very long ago to be the keynote speaker at Kansas Fest. So a lot of us had a chance to actually see him talk and talk about that.
Yeah, that was a fanboy moment for me. Yeah.
So it's he was, you know, I think he was very happy to be there. He had a lot of fun talking about, you know, both his sort of approach to business and kind of just how this magazine went. And so I don't know to what extent this is obvious to everybody, you know, the effect that Nibble had, but it was a really big deal in the Apple II world. I mean, like, that was the magazine in which you had programs. And one thing that we learned from his keynote is that he wrote half of them. But a lot of things that you know, could type in and learn how to program, and, you know, interesting utilities and little games, and it was interestingly technical. Like, that's how a lot of us learned whatever we did actually learn.
Nibble magazine and Byte magazine were my two benchmarks that I gauged all other magazines by, and that was a pretty both of those were pretty big hurdles, especially Byte. Now, that's a massive hurdle for other magazines to emulate. But Nibble was something that I purchased. At university, we used to basically take turns in buying it because none of us could afford a subscription. It was almost our go-to reference and program collection. And now, then I enter the working world and whatnot, and the interesting thing is that I then struck up email conversations with a Mike Harvey with the mainframe software that I was responsible for, and I thought to myself, it's just got to be a coincidence. And several years down the track, and I thought, I'll ask, and lo and behold, been discussing mainframe installations and configuration and whatnot with effectively my hero. I had no idea that he was in the mainframe world as well. So like, I'm trying to sort of contain myself, sort of like not do a fanboy email back to him. But he found it quite a humorous anecdote when I caught up with him at Kansas Fest. That must have been 2016, I think. It was a sad passing, but at least he was the, as you said, the owner, editor, and also the publishing house for Nibble magazine. They basically did everything in house, at least all the books and the magazine itself is available in DVD collection. All of the software has basically been collated together. So Stavros, great call out to him for doing that, and that's available to download. So although the magazine itself is a DVD download purchase, a DVD purchase here, the family are now back to emailing responses and mailing out the DVDs that people have purchased. So,
I was going to ask about that. Do you know if that's?
I don't know if they're going to continue it. Yeah. His son basically contacted some people who actually had put orders in for the DVD and were following up as to why hasn't it arrived, because everyone was saying, Mike Harvey, you order it, you'll get it in good time. And then suddenly there were these orders that were not being fulfilled. I think that's how basically the news went back into the Apple and retro computing community, because, it was totally out of character for Mike to not be pushing out the fulfillments. Mm. And I suppose, unfortunately, he had the best of excuses. But his son has stepped in and is getting it there. I'm hoping that if the family isn't intending to keep the site going, because it's also got Mike's paintings there. So he was also a prolific painter, and there are some great examples of his artwork there. Totally not computer related, but they are some nice pieces. I think that some of them were even available to purchase as prints. So I would like to see the Nibble magazines, the books and the collections to still be made available. And there's also a lot of software, which Mike, as being pointed out, wrote himself and is still available for distribution. So I would like to see it still available.
Yeah. Yeah, I assume that so this is at nibblemagazine.com, and I'm assuming that at least that is or will shortly be captured by the Internet Archive. But it would be, yeah, I am curious to know what the future of these scans are, because Nibble Magazine is everyone should have the opportunity to read it in some way.
Yeah. Oh, it's tremendous, especially the fact that the all of them are available. So from the very simplistic black and white stapled together ones in the early days, through to the classic ones. The artwork of the covers itself are tremendous. Sometimes you'd spot it in the newsagent. There's the new Nibble magazine. Oh, that looks nice. I'll check to see what's inside as well. But never disappointed. Loved the one-liner and two-liner programs at the back of the magazine. The feet, normally it had two or three feature software packages to type in and use, as well as the news and views of what's happening. And the best part of the whole magazine were his editorials, which call Apple in conjunction with Mike, put those together and released that as a book of his collective musings. And again, these aren't necessarily computer related, but they are business related, they are life related, and that in itself, I love reading his editorial every issue that came out. So I was very happy to grab a copy of that book and to get Mike's autograph when he was the keynote speaker. So, Vale, Wale, Mike. So.
You mentioned he was an artist, but I don't know if you said, was any of his artwork in Nibble then? Did he do any of the designs?
I don't believe that he did any of the cover art. Mm. But if you go, I think there's a link at the nibble.com to some of his paintings. Mm. So as far as one Retro Computing Roundtable episode goes, two of my rock star heroes have been mentioned in passing. So, yeah, not many of my rock star retro heroes left. So I'm hoping they can hang in there for another 3, 4, 5, 6 decades.
Well, Carrington, your next news item has me worried. No, you're not next.
Who will be mentioned next on the RCR Show of Death?
No, but it sounds like we're looking at another looming infrastructure crisis.
Yeah, they're calling it the Y2K20 bug, but I like to think of it as the Y2.02K bug. The Macintosh is dead. Dead, I say. No, actually, there's a problem with classic Mac OS in that you can't enter a date beyond the year 2019. It'll handle a date later than that because all the Mac people were super smug when Y2K came around. It said, "Oh, we can handle things forever." I was one of those people, so I'm perfectly fine saying this.
And your impression was great.
It sounded just like me. But you can't enter a date in the date and time control panel past December 31st, 2019. So if you fire up your Classic Mac now and try to enter a date, it won't let you. Haha. If it's got a date already in it, that goes later than that, because it'll go until 2040, February 6th, 2040. So come back to that show in 20 years and we'll talk about it. Now there's nothing you can do. So yeah, so if you've got a Classic Mac right now, you can't enter the current date in it. Using the date and time control panel. But luckily, there is a utility that's now been put out called Set Date. So you can grab that instead, and you can use that, enter a correct date, and it fires it into the Mac, and the Mac will operate fine and keep the date correctly.
So it's just a hack to keep your Mac going until 2040. It's a Mac hack, but it's a hack. It doesn't solve the problem. In 2040, you're gonna have that issue. But yeah, it's not just the date entry. Not mentioning any names of companies and things, but I have firsthand knowledge, experience of applications that use the 19 century flip. Some of them were put in as Y2K fixes. Air quotes, folks, that was not a fix. And so basically, I've encountered systems from my clients where I've had to point out that the date is not 1920. Yep, so 2019 was good. Put in 20 and you got 1920. So there are, you know, remedial activities probably all around the world going on now in places where the century flip. Because everyone in doing their Y2K thought, oh, yeah, this will all be out of the way. We'll be using marvelous PC systems and things by then. And funnily enough, it's some of these PC systems that are now dying on the 19 flip date.
I think it's more that a lot of people thought, there's no way I'll be working here in 20 years.
I know that we've dragged, kicking and screaming, a lot of analyst programmers to the Y2K keyboard. Some of them basically were getting some very good hourly rates to fix up programs because they spreken to APL and spreken to COBOL and to fix things up. But
The fix of just saying, well, okay, well, if it's somewhere below 20, then, you know, we'll assume that it's in the 2017, 2018. But I could see the advantage rather than trying to deal with something more complicated. Just say, well, okay,
two-digit years are fundamentally monstrous. ISO 8601, people, is the only proper date format. You Americans do your month and day wrong. And everyone should use ISO 8601. Flag
of the Hallelujah. Hallelujah, brother.
Yes.
Just, I think maybe, this is like last night as we were recording. I forget his full name, but on Twitter he's Foone, F-O-O-N-E. Went on a bit of a digression about the looming, whatever it is, like 2038 bug that we're going to hit. The number of seconds since 1970.
That's overflows.
And you know, this the Y2K bug and the like, little threshold fixes that people did and stuff like that are all they're sort of like human user problems. But the second since the Unix epoch is computers deep in their brains talking to one another and doing computations, and that's going to be horrible.
The only good thing is a lot of current politicians are doing the best to end the world before then, so it might not be a problem.
Yep.
They're on this.
Yeah.
Man, that's only 18 years away. That's only 18 years away. I remember when I first read about the number of seconds since the epoch.
It felt like forever.
Felt like, oh, well, just whatever. Yeah. I mean, I'll probably be retired, but still, man, that's like, that's sooner than you think.
So you see my lifestyle? This is your problem.
The end of the Unix epoch is actually on my 67th birthday. So I'm going to count down that I'm going to be retiring on that day. So that I won't have to deal with the problem at all.
What you mean is you'll be making megabucks remediating it.
Well, be careful. You want everything to have been processed, finalized, converted into gold bullion.
Right. It's my retirement is safe.
So that when the thumb by thumb hits the fan.
You heard it here, folks. This is life-saving.
Show titles, it'd definitely be thumb by thumb.
I think so. We do.
Oh, do. Then it's definitely Thumb by Thumb.
Okay.
It could be messy when the Thumb by Thumbs hit the fan because, oh, there's going to be digits everywhere. 8 bits all over the place.
Wow. This episode's been all over the place.
Yeah. Well, I've got to go get a rake and go out and put those bushfires out. So, yeah.
Well, before you do that, though, Paul needs to tell us what he's got from the 99ers here.
Yeah, well, and then Carrington has another one, too. This is going to be a good all week, but no,
I got more. No. I just kept throwing stuff in the notes.
Just farther down.
Yeah, I'm just going to go check the obituaries for any late entries.
You're right. So, James wrote over email a feedback thing, which I thought I would expand into an item of interest or news, and I guess interest in this case. And so James mentioned that in episode 200, we mentioned the TI-99 for a MBX expansion system. And I did not know very much about this. And in fact, I barely remember talking about it. But it was basically something that you could tack on to the TI-99 4A. It added a bunch of stuff. So it added a joystick with like a pistol grip analog joystick with 3 buttons, which is way better than TI's very poor single button joysticks. It had the joystick had a trigger and a paddle. It had voice recognition. It had speech synthesis. It had an internal speaker, 8x8 programmable keypad, which you could have overlays with. It's just like a monster expansion thing.
It was a better computer.
Yeah. Well, it was, in fact, yes.
Put this better computer beside your old computer and everything will work out okay.
So it came out 2 months before TI pulled the plug on the 99 4A. And so it is hard to get because they are rare. The story was, I guess, that Milton Bradley was developing its own gaming console, which they canceled as soon as the ColecoVision came out because that was like they just decided there's not enough space in the market for this. But then they sort of repurposed it to be the TI MBX. So they went with the current top seller and said, we will attach ourselves to this. And then like 2 months later, TI pulled the plug. Atari wanted it, so TI blocked it by signing a 1-year exclusivity deal.
That's a spirit.
But eventually Atari got something similar, which is the Voice Commander. But the MBX is a 6809 8 megahertz gaming console. It's much more powerful than the TI-99 4A that you connect it to. And it communicates through the joystick port with the TI and uses the cassette port for ground. It uses memory space originally set aside for accessories. And then we were corrected. I don't even remember making such an assertion, but I guess hypothesized that it was using the speech synthesizer memory space. Anyway, yes. So I think it's kind of cool. There's a link on videogamehouse.net that sort of goes over this. And James had said that he recently got one for $60 on Shop Goodwill. It had no power supply, but he found like a $5 substitute. And he wanted me to mention, remind people of the existence of Shop Goodwill. That is a place that you can find. Mm. You can often find things sort of eBay-like for pretty cheap. I find the interface terrible.
Yeah, but it's not a good interface, but it's interesting that occasionally you can find some real winners on there.
Yeah.
Well, I don't want them to update the interface because I think it might deter some casual shoppers.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Keep it bad.
Oh, no, I'm supposed to be cutting back, aren't I, on my imports. Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, I've gotten a couple of things up there, and I think if you can manage to find them, the competition is lower generally because nobody else wants to go through it. And I think fewer people just look. So it's probably not a great place to, it's basically, I think what it is sort of like a combined Goodwill stores all kind of like participate. So it's coming from an individual store somewhere, but they all sort of list on that site. Anyway, okay, so there's a couple of links. There's a link to a topic on the Atari Age forums about this that sort of shows the specs. And you can see one. I have a link. We probably don't need to spend a lot of time with it, but there's currently one listed on eBay for a 750 buy it now. That is, I think, in a pretty good shape. And there was one that I think may have been the one that we mentioned before that sold for $150. So finding one for $60 on Shop Goodwill is extremely good. And that's the end of my item of interest.
All right. Well, Carrington, you have something for VI on Turbo C++. Best editor ever, by the way. I love VI. So what you got?
Well, then, if you love VI and you also sort of miss Borland Turbo C++, then you are the very specific niche market for this product, which is called Quick UI. Quick UI for VI. Vim Quick UI, actually. It basically will give you the look and feel of Borland C++ in your VI editor. Pretty cool. So if you're doing it, it adds like drop down menus, color, like the whole thing. It's just like bingo, you are now in a retro C++ editor, but in apparently Earl's favorite actual editor. So it's free. It's on GitHub. It's downloadable now. There's got to be a few people about this that are super excited about it. And if you're one of those people, then this is for you. I love things that are super niche like this. It isn't for me, but it's amazing that it's for somebody. I love it.
I think I'm in that teeny tiny intersection in the Venn diagram because I loved the Turbo IDEs, spent huge amount of time in Turbo Pascal and Turbo C and that. So, and love VI. So, yep, I'm going to check this out.
Yeah. So this is for Vim 8.2. Two or more.
This is gonna accidentally fall onto my work machine.
Yeah, this is great.
Nice.
Yep. So you got to use Vim, which I think is VI improved.
Maybe
Vim 8.2 or later. And if you're running that and you want it to look way older, then this is for you. I think it's really cool. I love it.
So I think if you're on a modern Linux distribution, you probably are running Vim. As opposed to just the older VI. I think that's usually the case.
Yeah.
I think that also.
All right, cool.
So there you go. A little bit of not death to round
up. Yes. Thank you.
Nice.
There's some joke that goes around that, you know, like if you want to get around an assortment of key presses, what you want to do is like put people in VI and tell them to quit.
Hey, I had more trouble with Emacs, though, trying to figure
some
out
say
how to
they still have
get out of that. Yeah, I think there's got to be at least two or three machines out there in the world that are still running Emacs because I could never exit. Yeah. Well, let's talk about shows, places where you can go talk about these things with people face-to-face. Like, for instance, in my neck of the woods, the VCF Pacific Northwest, March 21st and 22nd in Skedaddle, Washington. That's at the Living Computer Museum Plus Labs. And it's a fun show. Have been, do love, will go. So come on out to that one.
Have been, do love, will go. Okay.
The next one on our list is the 29th annual last Chicago Cocoa Fest. Always the last one, never the last one. It's so awesome. April 18th and 19th, 2020 in Elk Grove Village, Illinois. And also VCF East. One of the best shows of the year, honestly, if you can make any show and you don't mind some travel, if like you're a West Coaster like me still, this is an amazing show always. It's April 24th through the 26th at the Info Age Science Center, I think, isn't it, in Wall Township, New Jersey. We'll have a link for that in the show notes as well.
Yeah, I'm so West Coast, I'm actually East Coast of another continent.
That's true. You're like what happens when you lap yourself.
Yeah.
So.
Well, it is tomorrow here. Or is it yesterday over there? Okay.
Well, how is tomorrow? Can you tell us?
Hot.
Apparently.
Hot.
No, well, actually, it's cool, overcast, not getting any rain here. Strangely, some of the places that were being threatened by bushfires on Saturday, on Sunday, a cool change came through. So they went from being in the mid-40s to 15 degrees C.
Mm.
Yeah, so like that was one hell of a cold change coming through.
Which was probably quite helpful for the... Yep. Firefighting.
Yep. While I'm mentioning here, you know, we've got communities here that have been taking great measures to prepare for the oncoming bushfire, and one of them basically filled up a water reservoir that hadn't been used for many years. So the next roaring, rushing sound that some people heard was not the bushfire coming up the gully; it was actually a couple of million liters of water coming down the hill from behind them. Because the reservoir was not being used for a reason.
Mm.
hadn't been used for years. Some parents had basically had told their children, don't go playing there, it's dangerous. Mm-hmm. So they went and filled it up, and they said roughly the volume of two Olympic swimming pools of water came rushing down the hill at houses. So much force it actually ripped up a person's concrete driveway and dropped it in the front yard a couple of houses down the street. Oh my goodness. So,
wow.
So the bushfires are imminent. House has been flooded. You get it all here in Australia. So yeah, not only the animals trying to kill you.
I was going to say, the giant beasts there aren't enough.
But back to our normal broadcast.
Yeah, and with that, a word from our sponsor.
For those parents who realize that $600 isn't too much to spend to expand their child's world, Radio Shack has the perfect gift. The TRS-80 computer, the most significant investment a parent can make. Programs for your child's education or your business, finance, and home use. Let your children discover tomorrow's technology today. The TRS-80, the biggest name in little computers. Only at Radio Shack, a candy company.
And we're back. Okay, well, I hope you enjoyed that lovely vintage commercial, but it was for a TRS-80, so that's what we're going to talk about. It's some 3D items for the TRS-80. So tell us what you're seeing, Carrington. Are these not beautiful or what?
Teeny tiny 3D models.
Mm-hmm. Of TRS-80s.
Of TRS-80s, which are themselves teeny tiny.
Mm-hmm.
So it's awesome. Whole bunch of different stuff, badges and little tiny keyboards. And here's a keyboard badge. Neat stuff. Was there one in particular that we're going to recommend as the host gift?
I think the Model 3 would be my recommendation.
Mm-hmm. That looks nice.
That's just such a cool form factor.
Yeah. And it looks like the badges, mm-hmm. like so already immediately jumping off the thing that we were going to recommend. I think the badges are full-sized. So like if you want to mm-hmm. repair your yep. existing TRS-80, then this is also a place for that.
Or even if you just want to take one of these badges and stick it on your laptop and confuse people. I mean,
it's actually pretty cool.
Yeah.
Mm, wear it as a name tag. Anyway, neat stuff.
Yeah. And I think the prices are fairly reasonable, too, for these.
It's downright cheap.
Yeah, I love them as little three. Oh, those prices are, yeah, even translating the bags to Australian dollars, they're unbelievable.
$15 for the 3D printed Model 3?
Yeah. Not bad at all.
I wonder if Rocky Bergen's website has got a Papercraft TRS-80.
Mm-hmm. Those are cool.
Yeah, but this will hurt more when you throw it at someone.
Yeah, that's right.
I wonder how big this really is. I don't have anything like a quarter or, you know, some other sort of thing.
It's 1-to-1 scale.
Okay.
It's functional.
Perfect.
No, they're gorgeous. They're just adorable little 3D models. Love them. Mm-hmm. I like how the one we're picking, the Model 3 3D model says it's with 128K RAM because it's that model, but I think that's adorable. Mm-hmm.
No, yeah. they are cute. Love it.
I think I will probably end up buying one or more of those badges. Those are awesome.
Mm.
Badges?
Badges. But what we do need are eBay auctions. So, Carrington, can we count on you?
Oh, you can count on me. I've gone full Paul. First one is a full-sized Steve Wozniak standee.
Nice.
Yeah. I'm playing the Apple II as a guitar, looking happy. It's just, this must be around the time of the music thing he did.
Oh, the Us
that
Festival.
Music concerts, Us Festivals. So yeah, he's looking delighted and happy. Can you imagine this? I think it's around 6 feet tall. It's glorious. This is something to have in your house. I love it. It is $255. Buy it now, which honestly isn't that bad for a autographed 6 foot tall standee of Steve Wozniak.
But it has a make offer.
I dig it. Like I like it. I like it so much. I think it's amazing. So I recommend all of us rush out and watch Paul buy it.
Its shipping to me is only $22.
See, you can't afford not to get it. It is unfortunately very flammable, so maybe not the right time to buy it. But this is just the coolest thing.
But if I have this here in the 8-bit bunker, it'll be like one of my surviving rock star tech heroes will never leave me.
Mm-hmm. Oh, mm-hmm. Yes, he will. So I dig it a lot. My next one is a Hartley PR CCD. I didn't know what the Hartley PRCCD was, but I am in love with this device, having now read about it. So it is the CCD stands for cassette control device, and this is a buy it now for $60. Do any of you guys know what this is? Because I had to do some research to figure out what it was at all. And does it ring a bell with anybody?
Nope.
It controls cassettes. So the idea here was Hartley Courseware was this company that put out stuff for education, for courseware. And so this was a thing that an educator, a teacher could do to record stuff on a cassette. Like you'd record audio on a cassette. And then you could write a quick little piece of software, like a basic program. And using this, you can control the cassette, basically control the pause and play button, essentially. I don't think you can fast forward and rewind, but you can say, okay, stop, and now play. So I can see a lot of cool things you could do with this. But the idea originally was you would have your cassette and like some audio feedback or something, or you would pronounce something and say, okay, like here's the words in Spanish, now type it. And then your software would wait to get the correct response. And then once you've done the correct thing, it would hit play for a certain amount of time and play the next bit of the audio cassette. This could be really interesting to be used in games, in a whole bunch of stuff. I think this is really neat to have a cassette that you could remotely control with your Apple II. Even just to play music, you got one cassette that you can play through with your six songs or whatever that are your favorite songs. Your Apple II can play them, or to do audio that goes along with the game or something. I think this is neat. I had never heard of this before. I hadn't heard of the company before, but I really, really, really like it. So it's $60. Buy it now. I dig it. I think everyone should watch Paul purchase it.
Cool. I want to say for the record that this is the way that the cassettes on the Atari 8-bits all worked all the time, because they were all connected to the SIO port, and there was a control line. So basically you pressed like the solid ka-chunk play button on the drive, but the software could control when it was playing or not. And so there actually were a bunch of educational titles that used it for exactly this purpose, for playing some sound of a certain length or doing something for a while and loading another piece of software off of it. It was interesting. It was still kind of like, it was kind of crappy because it was, you know, you end up running a software off a cassette, which took time to load, but you could have actual recorded voice, music, whatever you want, and it would play back through the computer to the TV.
Yeah, the super cool part was that you'd have one track on the tape was the data, the other track on the tape was audio, and like Jack mentioned, it'd play the audio through the audio output of the computer. And I ran through one called States and Capitals, where it would, you know, stop and go, this state is this, blah, 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 talk to. At the same time that you were hearing this, you were also seeing the graphics on the Atari screen. So it was amazingly fun.
So can you, if you can't fast forward or rewind, can you, you can't stifle the audio either, could you? So, like, I'm just thinking, like, if you always have to play whatever is sequentially next, then it's not very optimistic if you're playing a game and you know, the next thing that gets played is, you lose.
Maybe. Like, I'm not sure, because this, as far as, right. I'm guessing a lot of this from, I found a write-up on Google Books. So in Resources in Education, Volume 18, Number 12, was the most detail I could find about this thing. Big book on what's available in resource. And there was an article on that that talked about this in general terms, how you can control a cassette and here's what you do for it. And then I'm deducing a lot of the control from looking at the cables that come off it. Because clearly one of the cables, the one on the bottom of the image I'm showing right now, for those of you listening at home, I'm showing an image. And it clearly is the kind that goes into a cassette, and there used to be remote controls on a cassette that could basically hit play and pause. And so this must be using one of those. It plugs into the joystick port, the internal little multi-pin joystick port inside on the motherboard of an Apple II, and then has a red cable, which I'm assuming is passing through audio. And then the two-pronged black cable is the remote control on old-fashioned cassettes. So I'm kind of guessing on what it does, but I'm excited about it anyway. I think it's the neatest thing.
Cool.
I dig it. I had never heard of it before, and I really like it.
And then that other DIP connector, did that go to – did you say this already? Did that go to, like, the joystick port?
Yeah, that's the joystick port. That's a joystick connector, the one that's inside on an Apple II. So I dig it. $60, buy it now. Paul will buy it shortly, so you can't have it. Paul's got it. Paul now has five of them. Next thing I want to look at is Spot On, which I thought was really fun because this is software for erasing your floppy disks or other things, Winchester removables, it says, and optical drives. This is from a crazy time on the Mac where it's like you could erase your floppy disk. Sure. You could even do a secure erase. Sure. But what if that's not enough for you? Buy this software and like really, really erase it. I just think it's like such super niche software. I really like it. So from MacPeak, I don't know MacPeak, but this is spot on and will like just like erase the heck out of your floppy disks. I just don't know why this existed, but you can have it for a bit of $14.95 or buy it now of $19.95. So if you've got a disk you have been waiting for like 25 years to just like a really erase, you've been so embarrassed by its contents and so worried about it, and for some reason didn't think just to like grab a piece of metal and punch it through it or fold it in half, you can now really erase it and reuse that disk. It's a very exciting moment for you. Paul's going to buy this. Aren't you, Paul? Aren't you?
I think I won't. But yeah.
It's cool, right? I think you will buy this instead because you can tell me what the heck it is. So this is an Apple IIe. That's easy enough. It comes with a joystick and a disk drive, but it also comes with the Cascades Graphics development, what this calls a DEC. As far as I can tell, it's one of those power bar type things you stick on top of an Apple II, but you can take your disk II and put it inside it. So there's a photo on the screen showing it. It fits over the top of an Apple IIe. I've never seen this thing before. This is the bottom of the Apple IIe, but here's a weird photo of kind of the back of this thing that sticks on top of the Apple II and gives you a bunch of pass-through power ports. It also has a photograph of the bottom of it and then a photograph of a Centrex cable, which I guess comes with it or goes through it, and it's a very taped up, really bad-looking Centrex cable. I don't know what this thing is, but Paul is about to tell us all. There's another cable that goes through it. Paul, what is this thing?
I have no idea.
Okay. Yeah. I thought it was just me. No. I tried to look for more info. I couldn't find anything, but it's the Centrex or this graphics development thing.
Is that plate on the left removable, do you suppose, so you could put another disk II in there?
Doesn't look like a big enough hole.
Like a poor man's Duo disc.
No, it's like, I think it's just a plastic thing. As far as I can tell, you put your disc inside it, it passes through power, and then for some reason also has a Centrex cable and this other weird cable. So, and I don't know if that's the other end of it. I don't know what this is. Why is it Centrex graphics development? Does this do something funky? I don't know. Maybe somebody has been waiting for one of these. Oh, and also goes with a joystick. Has been waiting for one of these to arrive. And now it is finally on eBay. It has a buy it now of $425. I think a bunch of people are watching it. I'm certainly going to buy it. I mean, you can't buy anything. Paul's going to snipe it. But I don't know what it is. I've never seen it before. I don't know this company. I don't know this thing. But it sits on top of an Apple IIe, contains a disk II, also contains a bunch of electrical receptacles, and maybe something to do with Centrex. $425. Have I sold it?
I mean, I think that would be like a printer interface, I think. My guess as to what this is that it's basically just somebody has a product, like a graphics development system, and they bought Apple IIe's as the brain of that, and then they just sort of repackage it and send it back out again. So this is probably something to run some kind of dedicated software that does graphics development.
Kind of thing.
Yeah.
Huh.
Cool. So it would have been sold like this as a packaged thing.
Yeah, yeah, and with some software for it.
How many of these do you have?
I've never seen one. I have none. But
Are you tempted?
No.
That's pretty cool. Yeah. Mostly my eBay picks are about trying to sell things.
It's interesting.
Ball.
Yeah. But yeah. So I wonder what's in. It does seem like there's space. Maybe there's something in that upper hood there too. I mean, like, so there's
on the left, like the other side, the opposite to the disk II.
Yeah,
because that's it's clearly a regular Apple disk II that's just been put inside this thing.
Right.
It's just a window to the front of an Apple disk II.
Yeah, and so there might be some more specialized hardware or something on the left side of that. And you can see that cage, you know, is holding something.
But the weird thing is, when you look at this, it looks like it extends back beyond the back of the Apple II quite far.
Yeah.
And it's also hinged. It's got a big piano hinge on the back of it.
Yeah.
It's a very weird device.
Yeah.
And can be Paul's for low, low price of $425.
I wish they'd shown us the inside.
It kind of seems like if it were free, maybe. I was like trying to figure out what it is. But I don't know. I don't know. It's also interesting that the plug, like, when I look at the way, so that we have these plugs in the back, you know, there's basically a little power bar, but, and they're all set so that they will interfere with the power coming in from the other side. Like the...
From the other side, yeah. Yep.
Oh, well.
If that's even power coming in, one of them is white, the rest are black, including the one on the side, so which one's, I don't know, it's all very strange.
Yeah. Anyway, interesting. Interesting that it exists. I wonder how many...
So unfortunately, I was unable to tell Paul any of my choices.
Right.
Except maybe that's life-size standee. You know you want it, Paul. You know you want it.
I might have this covered, though, Carrington, actually.
Okay, do it. Let's sell Paul some stuff.
So my auction pick, I looked at this, and in the description of this auction, it says, if you're looking at this board, you know what it is, which is not true. I looked at the board, and I didn't know what it was. So right off the bat, it's false advertising. But...
They've also spelled your wrong. What is it?
But I thought, hey, you know, it says Titan. It's for an Apple III. Paul's going to know what this is. So
Paul knows.
Great.
And how many do you have?
This is delegation at its best.
Yeah. So So Titan actually made a number of things. I think I have for a QX10. I think I have a QXPC card, which is a basically put a. Do you know what this is? Are all the QXPC? It's like a emulator.
Yes, I vaguely remember that.
Yeah, so you can run DOS software on your QX10 if you want, very slowly, I hear. But so it's that same company, and what the Titan 3 plus 2 would be?
That's Titan 5.
Yeah.
Right. Well, so no, Titan 5.
Yeah. The 5E. Yeah.
So the Titan 3 plus 2 would, you could put that in your Apple 3, and it would allow you to emulate an Apple 2 Plus with more than 48K of memory. So there's this backstory here, which is that it was a marketing decision in the creation of the Apple 3 that it would have Apple 2 emulation so that it would be able to sort of use all that software right away. But it would be limited to a 48K machine. So you, even though the Apple III itself had like 128 or 256K or whatever, it would only emulate a 48K Apple II. So that, I think that kept you from, that may have kept you from running ProDOS. It definitely kept you from running a bunch of stuff.
I'll show you.
And it was basically marketing because they didn't want the Apple III to compete with the Apple II. So they put a wimpy Apple II emulator in the Apple III. Like, they specifically put in hardware blocks to keep you from being able to do this.
I still...
That always works out so well.
I still don't get that. The Apple III was a more expensive machine.
Yep.
So they... Why would they think that... That one's always puzzled me. I guess I need to go read some more Apple history to figure out why they did that.
If you could go and run any of that Apple II software that's out there, you're not going to buy all this lovely, new, expensive, beautifully packaged Apple III software.
Well, unless it's better.
Unless it's better, yeah. So were they thinking then that people would buy an Apple III and an Apple II? Because that was definitely the economical option back then.
I don't know.
You should buy an Apple 5. Yeah.
5E.
Oh, sorry, I mean a 5E, which is a, 94? So buy the Apple 94.
So I think actually I think it might have been partly to push developers too, because if everything you write for the Apple II could also run on the Apple III, then why write anything for the Apple III? You know, just write everything for the Apple II and then they'll use it too. So, I think that might have been part of the thinking. But anyway, so what Titan did is they made a little plug-in board. You can see it actually. It's on the screen now, the Titan 3 Plus 2 that will emulate an Apple 2 Plus that has a full 64K. And then the Titan 3 Plus 2E is a second board that connects to the Titan 3 Plus 2 that will give you the rest of the 2E in an Apple 3. And it takes up two of four slots that you have in the Apple 3. So
actually, if you were going to buy this board, it wouldn't make any sense to do it.
Yeah, sell it to Paul.
If you didn't already have the first board that kind of requires this. Is that what you're saying?
Well, I think this has both.
I think this looks like it comes with both.
Yeah. So I think that was normally how these were sold. But, you know, so the Titan 3 Plus E had a Titan 3 Plus 2 in it and a second board. I do see two boards in the third photo. So, but yeah, these things are,
I think that looks like how it's packaged as well, because it's the Titan 3 plus 2E. Yeah. So I guess you probably could buy this as just the original one, presumably with the 2 plus board, and then you could probably buy just the 2E add-on board if you already had the other one. I mean, that's how I would have sold it.
Yeah,
it seems like it was a crazy time.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I've never seen a Titan 3 plus 2E by itself that says requires the other board, but. Anyway, yeah, so these are pretty well sought after. I mean, you can kind of tell by the buy it now price of $600. But I did buy one set that didn't cost too much. And then I lucked into another machine that had one in it, because I think they were pretty popular at the time. So
oh, sorry, Earl, you picked something where he already has two.
striking out here today, Carrington.
Sorry. they're neat. I brought one to Kansas Fest, actually, when I brought an Apple III with these boards in it, without the case, but with everything else, and played around with it a little bit there. It's I don't know, it's neat, but of course at this point, you know, I don't need an Apple III to run an Apple IIe. I can just use one of the many Apple IIes that are sitting next to the Apple III. So...
All right. Well, thank you for educating us on that. I appreciate that. Educating me. Now I feel like, you know, I don't have to have the cognitive dissonance of looking at the board but not knowing what it is. Now I know what it is.
Yes.
So, Michael, you're up next. You had the Micro-B that we talked about, but I think you had something else also, didn't you?
Yes. This is one of the Heathkit continuing education series. It's not one of the ones which I'm personally tracking down. I'm more interested in the ones that have the printed LPs in there. But Heathkit, along with Heathkit Zenith as well, did an amazingly large number of practical courses, self-teach packages. And this one is basically a manual along with some DC electronics to go in with the course. So it's basically practical exercises along with the theory. And then what you could also do with these is that you could get an assessment package, which you would then complete, or I suppose you could pay someone or get someone to do it for you. I don't know how they did it, but that was basically a self-teach educational system for electronics. And they've got an amazing range of other packages out there. Now, the two that I'm currently working on at the moment are DC and AC Theory, and they come with a total of about 26 sides of audio LPs, which I'm in the process of digitizing. But this is a more recent one. It comes with a pair of cassettes. So, ironically, that would make it more difficult for me to digitize, as I would have to go and get a cassette deck to hook up to my system down here. But quite a reasonable opening bid of $19.99. It's currently showing that it's only got 1.5 hours to go, but it and others from this seller have been... coming around quite frequently. So if this one's not picked up by Paul within the next minute, an hour and a half, it will be relisted.
I'm looking at this picture here on my own screen. These components are gigantic. That resistor, you could probably see the color codes from space.
You could pick it up and beat someone with
it. Yes. Giant relay. I bet that transformer is not light. I mean, what are they charging to ship
Well, for me, it's actually quite reasonable. As part of the international global shipping program, they're actually only charging $28.71 shipping. Mm-hmm. So if you were to pick that up for $19.99, that would be quite a good deal.
Yep, and $17.48 shipping for me in Canada.
You would be then gouged an extra 10% GST, which will go to our esteemed federal government. Long may they burn in. Long may they govern. It's one of the more reasonably priced Heathkit educational packages that are out there. Some of the ones I've been picking up are sort of by the time I even have them transshipped out of my Oregon service, they're normally in about the $100 to $150 US landed here in Sydney.
Hmm.
But, they're what have currently got my interest as far as archiving and packaging up. So there's quite a lot of sheets there to scan, which is why I'm sort of trying to find my scanner, which is also the reason why I've bought another one, just so I can actually have two going.
Super cheap shipping to me, $5.87.
That must be, they must be sending it through the media mail.
Yeah, very, very cool. Economy shipping, it says.
Yeah. Oh, economy shipping, not even media mail. Mm-hmm. Okay, I was going to say, if they send a media mail, that's sort of like just asking to be opened up by someone at the post office to see if it complies.
Awesome. Well, Paul, if you're not going to buy any of our stuff, are you going to buy any of your own stuff?
I don't know. I got some pretty expensive stuff here.
I mean, one that you've got is like super exciting. I've always been fascinated by the 68,000. People who, and Jack, maybe you can confirm this because you did some work on it, but people who have programmed 68,000 have told me it's an amazing chip from an assembly language perspective, from an architecture perspective, very well laid out. Some have compared the architecture of it actually to like the PDP-11 processor architecture. So anyway.
I guess I've known anything about the PDP-11 architecture, but yeah, the 68,000, like I would say it's probably one of the last CPUs designed where the assembly language was designed to be written first and foremost by humans rather than first and foremost by compilers. Mm-hmm. It's like a modern CPU has so many instructions, so many different options and quirks that they're really meant for a compiler to output the assembly language because a human, there are just too many things to do. Or there are too many ways to go to optimize it properly. So, yeah, when I did some 68,000 in college, I liked it. It was fun.
Well, you could do it again on the Apple II, it looks like.
Yeah.
So what are we looking at here? What is this?
So this is the DTAC Grounded board. And for some reason, the auction is listed as the DTAC Grande board. But anyway.
Ooh, you get it cheaper. Yeah.
Not a venti.
Yeah. But anyway, it's a 68,000 board that you can connect up to an Apple II with an interface card and then sort of control it. So it's kind of like a coprocessor for the Apple II. These were, I can't even remember how much they were, but I think they were five digits of dollars. Mm. You know, these were super, super expensive things. And I don't think I've ever seen one actually for sale before. This one currently is $1,800 buy it now, basically, in US dollars. So I haven't seen one before. It's a little more than I feel like I'm ready to spend, but I, you know, like it's rare enough and it's interesting enough that it might not be crazy. But anyway, so yeah, so if you wanted to, the thing is, I don't actually know what people use these for.
They use it to lighten the load in their wallet.
Yes, exactly.
You're saying it was five figures back in the day. It's not exactly cheap today either.
Yeah, right.
Well, what would it use for mass storage? Did it use the Apple II drives?
Oh, yeah. No, I think basically it looks to me like it's basically just got a bunch of RAM and then the processor on this sideboard, and everything else is just using the Apple II stuff. But so we talked a little bit with Don Burtis on the Drop 3 Inches podcast. This is where I had sort of first come up with this, or first come across this, because so Don Burtis is the one who designed the soft card for the Apple II and Apple III, and he did a bunch of, he did a number of other things, but he also worked with the people who made DTAC Grounded on how to make their interface. So if you wanted to hear him talk about it a little bit, basically I thought, I went back and checked, and I thought it was going to be sort of more impressive than it was. Basically, he, you know, we asked him about it, and he said, "Oh yeah, we did work on that." And that was about all there was on that. So it's mentioned, but there's also a newsletter, DTAC Grounded. So I have a link to the first of them, but there's actually, that is, looks like there were issues all the way up to 45 in September 1985. The first one was July 1981. So apparently there are enough people using this thing that it was worth making a newsletter for them. So anyway, it's interesting. Something I want to dive into at some point. I don't think right now is that point, but it was interesting because it came up in the search.
I think part of the problem with getting something so super rare like that is if you got playing with it and if it breaks, how are you going to fix it? I mean, maybe some of the components are common enough where you might be able to find drop-in replacements like the RAM, or if it's a not soldered DIP 68000, maybe you could find another one from somewhere. But it's just like it'd be kind of tough to troubleshoot if it broke.
Right. Yeah, and I imagine finding the 68000 itself is not the hardest part, but you know, all of the support structure around it and however it is communicating with the Apple II.
Mm-hmm.
This auction seems to have some kind of power unit.
That looked like an outboard DC power supply.
Yeah. I don't know what this thing is that's next to it. The thing that looks like a Mac Pro. because it actually looks like some kind of relay thing or something. But
what else are you not going to buy?
Okay, so here's another one. the theme is kind of similar, I guess. So this is it says Super Rare Apple Macintosh 2 Texas Instruments TI Nubus Micro Explorer. And none of those words meant anything to me, really.
Nubus, I've heard of these words, actually.
Yeah. But it said something like Symbolics Machine, I would have known what that was. This, it turns out, is like it's sort of a competitor. As an alternate version of that kind of thing, it's a Lisp machine. So you plug it into a Macintosh 2. The Macintosh 2 provides all the kind of like support structure, but on the card is basically a Lisp machine that will run, you know, some kind of Lisp operating system. And it's I don't know that much about them actually, but they're basically hardware optimized to run Lisp. And so Symbolics made a bunch of these.
What year was this? From, you think?
I don't know.
Let's look at the date codes on chips.
Although, I mean, Macintosh 2, so it's whatever time frame Macintosh 2 was. I guess that would be 90.
Released March 2, 1987.
Okay, and there's
Jack and Google.
Nice, well done.
And I have there's a brochure for the Micro Explorer, the TI Micro Explorer computer system, and that brochure is dated 1988. So anyway, it's pretty interesting. I think it would be kind of fun to play with one of these things, although I sort of feel like it's over my head. So I fear that if I had one, I would barely know what to do with it.
It's kind of interesting to me because they spent big bucks when I worked in aerospace in the late 80s, big bucks on various things related to Lisp. And I don't know what they were doing with it. And they said if, you know, they could tell me, but then they'd have to kill me. It was in, you know, it had to do with product design and some CAD/CAM stuff and that kind of thing. But I don't imagine that this was cheap back in the day.
No, I'm sure not. Though it does seem like a more compact thing than most of the other kind of like Symbolics related stuff I've seen. You know, like this, it's managed to pack an entire Lisp machine into a card that you can put in another computer, you know. And there were, I'm blanking on the name of it, but there were, I think, Symbolics ones that you could get for the Mac 2 also that competed with this. But anyway, this would be the way I would like to play with it. I would not like to have to try to set up a machine with, like, the 6-inch square, you know, like, boards that you have to assemble into some order on a backplane that I don't understand. This, I think, I might be able to do. And I think it's interesting just because I'd never heard of this before. I mean, like, so it's quite possible that other people who are interested in Lisp machines wouldn't have known to look for a Micro Explorer.
No, and it uses HyperCard, according to this brochure.
Cool. Even better.
I dig it.
Yeah.
Cool.
Interesting niche piece of hardware.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The next ones are sort of quicker. But so the next one I have is a vintage sealed box of Apple II diskettes. And what's interesting about them is just basically that they are official Apple, you know, diskettes from whatever that was, 1980.
Oh, that is so cool. How much do they want for this?
Well, it's a bid. So it's currently at $14.95. But
So this is sealed, but some of the photos show a disc.
Right.
So must have other boxes that are open?
Yeah, because it turns out, I don't know how many this seller has, but many. several have sold. One of them sold for $132.50. Another one sold for $29.
Interesting. Do you know who Apple OEM'd from back in the day? I mean, Apple probably didn't manufacture these.
I don't, but I know that they were, well, I know some of the ones that they actually produced their own stuff on. So I'm not sure about the blank ones, but the ones that they had, like the System Master and the Basics and stuff, some of them were even hard sector disks, because the Disk 2 doesn't care about the index hole that marks the sectors. Mm. And so you can get 10 sector hard sector disks, which they look really weird because you can see all those little holes through the window. But if you're trying to image them on a CryoFlux or, you know, one of those sorts of things, the thing goes crazy because it thinks that the disk is spinning like 3,000 RPM. But anyway, it's kind of cool.
This is still pretty cool. I'd love to have some of these.
I don't want to spend $132 for them, but and who knows if this is the last one.
$15, sure.
Yeah. The next one I have is what I, in the show notes I put, I think it's a 6809 fourth machine, but it's a Exidy Sorcerer. It's a nice one. It appears to, you know, they show it actually showing things on the screen.
Well, they show a screen.
Yeah, true. We'll just take their word for it.
This computer doing it.
I think they look pretty nice in the photos. I have a feeling that, like, if you hold one, it's going to feel kind of cheap. But and I like the way that they have a cartridge slot for cartridges that are basically built out of repurposed 8-tracks.
The best.
Yeah. But it's kind of nice. It has it looks nice. It has all its keys. It seems to do something. It has a basic cartridge and a manual and some kind of, I think, prototyping cartridge PCB as well.
Well, we've long established on this show that we have no idea what this thing is.
Right.
And we refuse to learn.
Yeah. In the description, it says it was introduced in 1978 and it uses a Z80 or Z80 processor.
I'll tell you which of those two is correct.
Yeah. Shall I keep going? I don't know. I feel like...
Do it.
Okay. All right. Next one. Here's another one I hadn't seen before. I thought it looked cool. Yeah, I'm sure Carrington will like it a lot, but
no, he will not.
So this is an HP Integral personal computer, and it seems kind of old to me. It's 1985.
It looks brand new.
Its condition is great. It has a 3.5-inch disk.
Its condition is suspiciously good. Was this like just create? Oh, I guess there's a bit of scuffing on the front.
Yeah.
But wow, this thing looks completely untouched.
Yeah. So it has a little, it looks like a little tilting monitor that luminesces in some kind of amber or yellow. It has a pretty compact keyboard. I think one of the things that's coolest about it is it has actually an onboard inkjet printer. Mm. I mean, because it's HP.
Is it a printer on top?
Yeah.
Yep. It totally is.
And I think that was the thing that kind of tipped me over the edge to putting this in here is that, you know, it has a printer. I've never seen one of these have a printer.
The memory module cartridge in the back, that's pretty good too.
Yeah.
512K one. Oh, nice.
Well, and I mean, like, there are few enough of these things around that I imagine if you actually wanted to get one of those, this might be the way to get it, you know, inside. Mm-hmm.
It's too bad it's not showing to be really working. The screen lights up, but there's nothing on it.
Yeah. And it might be fixable. I don't know.
They say it stays blank most of the time. Sometimes it actually boots into HP Manager and everything seems to work fine. So there is a known and advertised problem with in it, but still that's
it's located in Quebec as well, and yet
it's not only is it located in Quebec, it's located in Montreal.
Which is where you are at the moment, right?
Yeah, you could take it.
Paul.
Imagine the shipping you can save. You can just pick it up.
I don't even need to imagine. I can read it right there.
You can't afford to not get this. Unless you have a couple of links to support documents as well.
Yeah. You'll have it fixed in no time, mate. Right.
Well, there's an InfoWorld article. What is this InfoWorld article?
It's basically... So it's sort of... Because I didn't know anything about this thing, I looked it up a little bit, and so there's an InfoWorld article. HP introduces the Unix Portable in January 1985, and shows this little thing.
Cool.
If you keep reading on through the article, it's a couple of pages long. Shares the second page with Coleco kills Adam.
We don't know who Adam was, but Coleco really was mad at him.
Which is appropriate for this episode.
That's right. But
and only $650 Canadian, which is stuff all in US dollars.
Yeah, yeah, it's like $500.
$500. Yeah. Yeah.
The Coleco Kills Adam article opens with Coleco will very definitely be in the computer business next year. Coleco is very content with its profit margins.
Yes, sir. This is
it's interesting that the article about launching this new computer with a built-in printer is at the same time that Coleco killed the Atom, which was the other, like, infamous computer that had a built-in printer all the time you couldn't get rid of.
Yeah.
But, it's a sweet little portable Unix machine.
Looks pretty cool.
Lots of points of failure.
Yeah, that's true. I failed to mention that it is a Unix workstation. Mm.
Is it battery-powered or only off mains?
Do not.
Could you use this on the flight home? Is my question.
That would be great.
Will you use this on the flight home?
It'd be the best.
This will look so good in your office, yeah. Paul.
Yeah, no.
You tell all your students they have to hand in their assignments in a way that's workable on this.
Right. I really do like it. I think it is very cool.
I'm sure you could get a step up transformer from the 5-volt DC from the USB in the plane armrest to 110-volt AC.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Excuse me, everyone sitting beside me. Could you plug this cable in? I need to steal your 5 volts.
Right. Just have a little spidery network out to everybody's armrests.
The best part is that there's somebody else on the flight who also has one.
Yeah.
Like, oh, dude.
We could play a network game.
That's why I carry that bag around. That's how you make friends, Paul. Just carry this everywhere. It's portable.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Time's wasting. Next thing I thought, here's another thing that I had not heard of before I started looking around. This is a Thinkadot computer game from 1965. Can computers really be fun?
Thinkadot is a computer game and is fun.
Yeah, I actually wanted this.
Oh, this assertion. Pair of assertions. It is a computer game and it is fun.
That's right. It is. It's so I don't know if it's fun, but basically what you do
I'll
is
tell you it's fun.
You drop little marbles in the top, and as the marble descends, it'll flip some little flip-flops that are in there that can affect whether the dots on the front are showing blue or yellow. And so, like, your task is to basically figure out, like, how to drop, in what sequence and in what holes to drop the marbles in order to get the pattern you want.
Hmm. Okay, I actually like this game,
yeah,
and I want to play it with you
cool
people at Kansas Fest.
Yeah. This is not super expensive. This one I picked is $32 buy it now, but... There are a few of them out there, and in fact, actually, there's somewhere you can find if you search instructions on how to 3D print one, basically. So, anyway, I thought it's kind of cool. It's the same people who made the Digicomp 1 and 2, too. Same company.
Cool.
So, Thinkadot. And I saw if you search around, if you care about this, search around for Thinkadot. And there was a presentation by somebody at one of the, I think, VCF events that who went through kind of like this Thinkadot and the Digicomp 2 and a couple of other things, I think, by the same company, like toys, computing toys of the 60s.
I'm just waiting for the iFixit teardown.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's one thing. If you do 3D printed, then that reveals the secret. You can see how all the little flip-flops work.
Well, and just remember, you don't have to think a lot to play Thinkadot.
That's right.
Can computers really be fun? I love everything about this. Yeah.
It's really great.
Especially because they don't. I guess they say this one's fun, but can computers really be fun? Eh, the answer is no. The box is empty. Right. Screw you.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you put in the marbles in the right sequence, and it steals your identity. And
where it went for somebody. This is where it started.
Okay. 0.1.
So just I had only listed a couple more things, and they're not super important. So first one was
this is one I like. So not even Apple's new Mac Pro is original.
Yeah, it's a sort of skateboard for your G3, iMac G3 or
my G4 Quicksilver would look great on that.
Yeah,
totally. This is amazing.
It's pretty cool. So it's basically something you set it on. This is for the sort of like the tall rectangle kind. You know, the tall box. G3 or G4s, and it has little sort of things on either end to keep it contained, and then one of them has a hole in it that allows the cords to go out, and then you can just sort of wheel it around on the floor. And
is this from like vintage or just somebody making it now?
I've never seen one before.
Seen one before either.
You know, it's probably it may well have been designed for this back when those were sold, but who knows. They demonstrate it by putting it on a carpet, which looks like a place where it's not going to roll very well.
But and it says one of the tabs was broken off and repaired with an epoxy.
Yeah, I don't see
hopefully back in the exact same place.
But there are close up photos, and I'm just I see it. Anyway, but apparently it's good enough. Anyway, it's a cool.
Thing. I like it a lot.
Never seen one before.
Cool.
Nope. And it's $20 opening bid. Yeah. Eight days. I dig it.
Yeah. Okay. And then the last one that I have is some Apple II cassettes. Two of them were from Muse, so that sort of connected to the Silas Warner discussion.
And what does Muse stand for?
Oh, I don't even remember. It says in the second photo. Micro User Software Exchange. So the Music Box.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah, and Maze Game. So these were, just examples of super early software, that you could get on the Apple II. The top two in the picture are Muse, and then the bottom one is Softape.
Cool.
So the Maze Game was written by Silas Warner, and Music Box was written by Ed Zarin, and Apple Listener was written by Bob Bishop. And
Bob Bishop.
Ed Zarin is still around. That's the positive part of this.
He said threateningly.
So it's interesting to see. I don't know that it's an $80 starting bid if you wanted to actually own these objects. I'm sure they've all been digitized.
I still love cassettes, though, just as a physical thing. Just have a soft spot for the cassette as an object.
Okay, I'm done. I made it.
You made it. Yeah. You did it.
Well, cool.
So the clock ticks to the second point fifth hour.
Well, yeah. It's been a little bit longer of a show, but I hope people will bear with us. It's the first time in a long time that we've had five of us here on the show. Sure. So I think that's awesome.
I blame the Australian.
So, too.
As usual.
I'm not naming names.
Well, we should do parting shots. Carrington?
Pew, pew, pew. I have no mouth and I must scream. I recently played the game. I've been wanting to play it for ages. The old point-and-click adventure game. Finally played it thanks to GOG, good old games, and it totally held up. I really liked it. So I recommend
Excellent.
It. Based on the old Harlan Ellison, well, you say novel, but it was really a novella, a little short, kind of a long short story, which was weird because Harlan Ellison, and was sexist because Harlan Ellison, but interesting and goes to neat places. And the game was cool and different and creepy, and I had to cheat a bit, but not too much, so it's accessible, and I like it. So if you like point-and-click adventures of the Scum variety, then and you want something like really freaky and weird, this takes place in a post-apocalyptic future in which all mankind has been completely decimated by intelligent computers, kind of in a what was the movie about the computer that takes over. I am Colossus, whatever the movie was called.
Fulbin Experiment.
No episode can go by without you saying, I am Colossus, voice of world
control. I am Colossus. Hear me, I'm the voice of world control. And so it wipes out everybody but saves five humans. The humans don't know why, but puts them in a version of hell and just like toys with them for hundreds of years. And this game, you play the five humans being tortured by the computer. It's weird and lovely.
Wow.
Oh, lovely might be the wrong word.
Was it originally a DOS game?
Yeah, I think so. I think it was originally a DOS point-and-click adventure thingy. I never played that, so I don't know if it maybe was available in platforms I had at the time, but it's available thanks to good old games. So GOG.com. I want to grab old games cheap. That's where I got it. I got it cheap, and I played it, and I liked it. So I played that one. Told my girlfriend about it. She lives in Canada. You wouldn't know her. I'm checking all the boxes. And she doesn't even like me saying the title of the game. I got that far. She's like, nope, stop it. What can you do? Another thing I want to mention really quickly is Blake Patterson, who you probably know from things like TouchArcade.com and, of course, the Bite Seller that we've mentioned before, which is amazing, for a long time now, I've been really, really into the game No Man's Sky. If you follow him on Twitter, which you should, then you would know that. He's just launched or is about to launch, but this show won't come out for a while, so whatever. the NMS Spot blog, so No Man's Sky Spot. I will be subscribing and reading because I really like that game. Don't have anything I can play it on anymore, but I have often been tempted to pick up a PS4 just so that I can then buy the VR stuff just so that I can then get back playing this game, but I'm not sure that I want to drop the $1,000 or whatever it costs to do that. Right. But yeah, I'm still tempted because I loved that game.
And you can see what it does to people, and you think, can I try this and not have it happen to me?
Maybe, but the thing is, like, I think it only appeals to maybe certain people. Like, if you want to play World of Warcraft, but you kind of wish there was nobody else on the servers. And maybe no monsters. You're just going to walk around the world
exactly
of World of Warcraft.
Better than Minecraft because I don't dig a hole and fall in it all the time.
Well, that's it. But if you want to just kind of walk around, it's like a walking simulator in space. And just like it appealed to me like crazy. Most people, I think, would hate it. It's really got an audience now. When it first came out, people were disappointed. I loved it from day one. Anyway, he loves it even more than me and has a new site. And I thought we would put a link into that. So NMSspot.com is the site.
Cool.
That's it. I have no mouth and I'm a scream.
Cool.
What about you, Jack?
I have a thing. I finally, after many years, I got myself a little Atari portfolio.
Oh, very cool.
About the size of a VHS tape.
So now you can hack ATMs.
Now I can hack ATMs, just like in Terminator 2. And one thing I want to share with you guys, which you can both well see, but it's actually even more audio. When I open this up near my microphone, it makes an incredible noise. I have a feeling that noise is not a good sign.
Not a good sign.
And it might light up here. So it seems to not. I've just got it pretty recently. It seems to not have a power button, but eventually, it just wakes up when you open it, and the screen lights up a little sort of
when it comes out of its crypt.
Yeah, Dracula awakens from his crypt.
Cool.
Anyway,
know the feeling.
It's neat. It's this one is a Swedish one. So it's got the funny Swedish characters on it and stuff.
Nice. Funny so, Swedish characters like Pippi Longstocking.
Cool. I don't know what I'm going to do with it, but I also got with it a. Excuse me. Wait while I close my device. I got a serial adapter, which is enormous. All this just to get a little DB9 port.
Like, yeah, that's like more than half the size of the portfolio.
Yeah, it's a huge thing, and it's like, ah. And then I can plug it into something and do something with it. So it comes with like kind of basic, kind of like PIM software essentially, and the spreadsheet and a word processor. In order to get more software onto it, you have to kind of like bootstrap the process by essentially writing a simple DOS script that will talk to the COM port and wait for data to come in that you cat to a file locally. And see, if, and the people have done this and worked it out. Their webpage is describing it. I've not yet done it. I think I have to get a serial USB adapter of some kind and some cables and things. But I look forward to messing with it more.
Cool. Say it comes with funny Swedish characters. I'm assuming that's Pippi Longstocking and the chef from The Muppets.
Exactly. Those are the main Swedish characters.
Yes. Those are the only two I know.
Yeah, they're the funny ones.
It's kind of sad that one of them is a Muppet. That's all I can think of.
It is. It's cool that I think probably the half duplexness of this caused that to make it not clear that, but we both said that same joke.
Well, but you can edit me out. So.
I think I'll see if I can make us say it in unison.
Final word.
Longstocking.
Right, Michael, any parting shots?
No, just gonna try and get things organized.
Fire.
Down here. Fire.
Yeah, stay safe, my friend.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
What about you, Paul? You land this plane?
I'll show one thing. Let's see.
And then tell one other.
Yeah.
Oh, what you got there?
It is a Province 8C. It's an Apple II clone from Bulgaria.
Wow.
It's cool. I took the power supply because I'm trying to make it work.
A hint. It'll need a power supply.
Yeah. Yeah, I went out and bought a voltage converter in order to be able to use it. And then I read the specs on the power supply that made it clear that I didn't actually need one. But, oh well. Mm. Now I have one for running a Spectrum or something.
Yeah, for the other Euro computers.
Yeah. But so that's fun. So I, at this point, because the power supply was dead and I'm not at home with all my many power supplies, I was not able to actually turn it on. But that I'm hoping in the future I will be able to have an Apple II that runs in Cyrillic.
Very nice.
Cool.
All right. Well,
I guess I woke it up. Look.
Nice.
It says something.
Oh, very cool.
The tiny screen. So,
who's the guy that lives on the roof?
Carlson.
Yes. Another funny Swedish character.
Very nice.
So, when you boot up, it tells you to enter the date and time, which I did weeks ago, and then it's been sitting there ever since in sleep mode. I don't know what I'm going to do with it, but I like it.
Unlike an old Mac, you can enter the current date and time.
Yeah, so it sounds just like whatever. We were just doing this last time. It sounds like you're, 130XE or whatever, right?
Yeah, it's creaky like a 130XE.
How old Atari's creaky.
All right. Well, I better close us out here. So that's it for this show. You can find the show notes for all the RCR shows at rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss us in the forums over at the VC Federation site, which we'll have a link up in the show notes. You can follow the Retro Computing Roundtable on Twitter at RCR Podcast. You can join our Facebook group. We've got lots of folks on our Facebook group. It's at facebook.com/groups/RCR Podcast. If you want to send us feedback, you can do so. Send it to feedback@rcrpodcast.com. We're a member of the Throwback Network. We'll have a link for that up in the show notes as well. And if you like us, or if you don't like us, what the heck, please write a review for us on iTunes. We'd love to see it. And until next time,
Retro Confused!